is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath Terra Firma in the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Grahamian Bunker, my friends, it is the Grahamian Report. Welcome to another week with your favorite cast of cretins, broadcasting from the depths of the Moho Discontinuity. Yes, I am Micah Hanks, joined in studio, as always, by producer Chris Hayes and the Reverend with the kind eyes, Mr. Matt Oakley. Gentlemen, how are we tonight?
We're absolutely fantastic, and may I just say to both of you, game on.
Game on! That's right. You know, it's another primary night in the South, and so we're all having a lot of fun together here, broadcasting from the Moho. And you, my friends, are about to hear incredible new feats of magic on the airwaves, because this is, of course, the Grahamian Report, your weekly hub for the strange and the unusual. Boy, do we ever have a lineup for you tonight. Dr. Rita Louise, the psychic doc's going to be joining us here on the program to discuss, well, intuition in the practice. I think that's going to be a fascinating discussion. We'll have other special guests dropping in throughout the program just as well. But for the time being, we'll go directly to the emails and address a few listener queries like we often tend to do here on this program. And we'll have some exciting news here in just a moment. Now, you know what? We'll get to the emails here in just a second. Let's go ahead and get right to the exciting news. Folks, I'm so excited because this week I want to...
You just can't hide it.
Could you put a lid on it?
Sorry.
Don't interrupt the exciting news.
Are you about to lose control and you think you like it?
I'm starting to like it, in fact, actually. You know, I was talking with my friend Sean today, and she asked, what's the station that's carrying you guys now? Is it a college station? And I said, Oh, no. Our new affiliate is all the way out in Washington. That's right. We are welcoming a brand new affiliate to the program tonight, because, well, to the Grahamian Report family, because our latest terrestrial radio station begin carrying the program is KCHW. That's 102.7 FM in Chihuahua, Washington. So we'd like to welcome them to the Grahamian family. Those of you in the Chihuahua, Washington area will be able to hear us. I believe it's a 9 p.m. time slot that we're going to be taking there, catching the rebroadcast, but we're glad to hear that KCHW 102.7 FM is now going to be carrying us. And that's in addition already to the Inception Radio Network, the Fringe Radio Network, and Psychic Visions Radio and Paranormal Parodies, which are already carrying this program. So if you haven't been hearing us in those three mediums already, if you're in the Chihuahua, Washington area, you'll be able to hear us on 102.7 FM. And growing. We're always interested in branching out. If you have a radio station in your locale that you think the Grahamian Report would sound fantastic on, email us info@grahamianreport.com. Pass the information along. We'll do what we can to work this out. We're always happy to offer different options in terms of getting the programs to people and things like that, and timing their clocks out and everything. Because, you know, radio's a very complex business. You know, especially when you're working with national and local spots and floating breaks and all this stuff and timing things out and top-of-the-hour news and station IDs and rejoiners and everything. So it's always a little bit of a headache when we bring on new affiliates, but you know what? We're always happy to work with them. So if you'd like to have the Grahamian Report on terrestrial radio in your neighborhood, well, let us know who to get in touch with, or have them contact us, info@grahamianreport.com. And that said, again, a warm welcome to KCHW 102.7 FM in Chihuahua, Washington, who are joining our family. And no, they don't broadcast from a bunker underground. They leave that to us. So with that said, that's some of the exciting news, and we're very happy to have them on board with the program. We'll go right to the emails. Shane writes, hey, GR crew, love the show. I just want to make a small request, please. I love the music that you play on the show, but I have no idea what most of the songs are called or even who the artists are. So could you include a track listing in the show notes? If you look at Mysterious Universe when you download the podcast to your iPhone, you can scroll to the bottom of the page info and it lists the songs and the artists in chronological order. That would be really sweet if you guys could add that to the website or to the podcast. Thanks a lot, Shane. Well, here's the deal with that. A lot of the music that you hear on this program is produced in-house. In order to present a entirely self-sufficient, unique radio listening experience with the Grahamian Report, we actually have a lot of the music that we feature on this program, including the primary theme music when we have the voice of God himself, Dick Oakley, talking over at the beginning. What are you laughing at?
God you just himself, call really?
Yeah, see, I happen to think that our voice guy, Dick Oakley, is one of the best in the business. We've got two incredible voice talents that lend themselves to this program. Not only does Dick Oakley do our voicer, but we also have John Anderson often that you'll hear coming back from the breaks, who is, John also is known as the voice of God. No, the voice of the mountains is John. So we've got the voice of God on one end and then the voice of the mountains on the other. So we hire only the best in the business, folks.
Unfortunately, we don't have talent on loan from God, though.
No, you do that and then you lose your commercial sponsorship.
Yeah, apparently.
You lose your commercial sponsorships if you have that. So, yeah, we avoid that like the plague. No. Oh, goodness. But anyway, we don't want to engage in the war against women here, though, so we'll leave that one alone. But apparently we're engaging in war against someone else, and I'll get to that in a moment. I do want to say that what music is not produced in-house on this program is typically featured by one of three artists, our good friends Rat Jackson, a group that is now defunct, but that is a group that is a friend of mine called the Evoca. Well, they were formerly the Evoca Project, and then they became Evoca, and now they're defunct. Members of that group were in another group, and then there was another group that's also now defunct called the Nova Echo, and the very talented Mr. Caleb Hanks, who is one of our Science and Futurism field correspondents, he was the man behind the Nova Echo, and he is also responsible for a lot of the in-house music that is produced for this program. A lot of people don't know this, but did you know that the main title theme for the Graylian Report that you hear at the top of every hour and going out to each break, did you know that that's actually a piece of music that I wrote and composed and performed myself?
Yeah, I knew that.
That is in-house talent on loan from Micah. Right there. Ladies and gentlemen, that is talent on loan from Micah.
Which translates to what? He who is like God?
You know, that's funny. Yeah. My name in Hebrew means he who is like God. But speaking about waging wars, another email. This is, I'm always concerned when I get an email and I have to contact law enforcement and tell them that we've had threats made against us. Without saying anything else, without condemning or condoning, I'm just going to read this next email because I think that sometimes the best place to hide something is just to put it right out in the open. This is not made up. This is not a skit that we've written. You know, Chris and I work very hard at writing, aspects of this program, and Matt's always coordinating things and firing the proper thing at the proper time so that this program flows neatly. But this is not something that we wrote or that we orchestrated. This is real. In fact, I don't think my in-studio staff are aware of what I'm about to read, so I'm just going to go ahead and cut to the chase, as they say. I write on behalf of the Hadal proletariat. We are angered by the ruthless and draconian rule that Chris Hayes have imposed on our people. He poisoned our princess into allowing our children to be processed and turned into potato chips.
Excuse me, I would like to refute that. They are Hadal tater tots.
My tots are not chips.
My tots are tots.
You're only making them more angry, if you don't mind.
If I'm going to be blamed,
Matt, would you
for
turn
something,
his, turn his microphone
I'd
off.
Like it to be the real
I thing. Mentioned we're on FM now, okay? Listen, this is getting bad. He markets our offspring as Hayes potato chips. With the slogan, "Betcha can't eat just one," because they're baby Hadals. Cannibalizing our youth for his sick gain is the last straw. We listen to your Graylian Report and hear you joke about Soylent Green. You think this is funny? We fight fire with fire, even though we hate fire.
It's true, they do.
We will steal your children and make them into sweet bite-sized cakes.
But full grown, you're half the size of our children.
Hold on. I'm struggling. Oh, God, I'm struggling to keep it together here. Okay. We will steal your children and make them into sweet bite-sized cakes filled with fruit.
What kind of fruit? I might be on board with this.
Figs, man.
Of course.
Okay. Well,
the time for reason is over. Prepare for war. So anyway... Just thought I'd put that out there.
May I have 30 seconds to respond?
They're going to turn your kids into Newtons, okay?
Which I will eat by the sleeve.
So you're going to eat your own? My God, man, that's sick.
Can I respond?
I think they're about to start fast-forwarding through this part to the interview if we don't go ahead and move along. But go ahead,
well,
yes.
I just want to say I don't even need 30 seconds. My deepest thanks to the Hadal proletariat for getting, my chip brand name out there. You've given me the kind of publicity that you couldn't buy.
Well, there you go. He's potato chips. Oh, goodness. Well, that was Mike the Angry Hadel. So, folks, we couldn't make this stuff up. I'm sure people think I'm literally making this up, but no, that's an actual email from a real, live, flesh and blood Angry Hadel, who's threatening to turn our children into Fig Newtons. Imagine that. So, anyway, when we come back, we'll be discussing the history of UFOs here on the program. What role do strange, unidentified objects in our midst play in the ongoing saga, the struggle of humanity as we know it? Well, we'll discuss this and more with our special guest when we come back right after this here on the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Keeping you company 8 to 11 Tuesday evenings. Boy, it's just one of those nights for me. I think I'm adjusting to the time change, you know? I'm still trying to get a grasp on this whole daylight savings time.
You know, it's pretty brutal.
So in real time it's 7:22.
Yes. Wait. It is?
Well, yeah. No. It's 8:22 by the clock, but my body hasn't adjusted yet, so it feels like it's 7:22.
Is that like time dilation, Chris, or something?
I think it might be.
I think I was struggling so much after that email from the Angry Hadel going out from the last break. It's funny. There are certain programs, though. I'll go on, you know, if it's a New York-based or maybe a Chicago-area radio program. I was on Grand Dark Conspiracy radio program last night. I don't even know where they're based out of, but it's funny because I go on these shows, and sometimes the first thing I hear when they have me on the show is they're like, "Welcome to the program, Micah Hanks." I'm like, "Hey, how y'all doing?" And they just start laughing. they don't know how to handle my Southern accent, which I guess having grown up in the South, I'm not so aware of the fact that I have a Southern accent. Is it really that Southern? Why don't you let me know? Why don't you email me, info@graylianreport.com. You can also call the studio if you ever care to. You're welcome to dial in, 828-398-4886, or send text messages anytime, 828-377-2201. And if you're not following us on Facebook yet, I would strongly recommend you check out the Facebook page. Just do a search for Graylian Report, and you'll find our Facebook page. You can also find fantastic Facebook pages for all kinds of content that we're associated with. Hey, speaking of, by the way, if you enjoy this, I want to direct your attention to one more thing. There is a new podcast that we are doing every week. Did you know about this? Now, Chris, before you start getting angry, because Chris is so angry, he puts 3 hours worth of work each week into this 3-hour show. Wait, no, more than that. There's a lot more work than the 3 hours that we spend on the air that goes into this program. He puts 2.5 hours a week into a 3-hour show.
You know, I'm only going to let you lambast me a few more times before
you
I come
back.
You
rip on me 13 or 14 more
times. Yeah, 13
times,
or 14 more times and I'm out of here.
I'll give you 5 minutes to quit that. Well, the thing is we are now doing a 1/2 hour or so, maybe a little longer than half hour, but it's going to be a weekly 1/2 hour or so Intrepid Magazine podcast. And I'll have information about where you can download that as well on this week's edition of the Graylian Report with the show notes. Which, of course, if you aren't already getting the show notes, if you subscribe to this via iTunes and you don't regularly visit the website, www.graylianreport.com, check that website out, because graylianreport.com is where each week we post show notes for the program. So those of you who are inclined to read along, well, you can do so. Now, that said, I'm working now in an editorial capacity with Intrepid Magazine. And tonight I thought I would give everyone a sneak peek, because in the upcoming issue we're going to be having a discussion with one of the granddaddies of modern ufology, a good friend of mine, none other than Mr. Stanton Friedman. And this morning I caught up with Stanton by phone, and we had a rather informal conversation for a little while there. It was about, 10 or 15 minutes. Kind of just chewing the fat about the state of ufology today and what's going on, because he's one of these guys who's been doing this for a long time. Stanton Friedman, if you're not familiar with his work, you've probably been living in a cave for 35 years or so. He was the first civilian investigator to really deeply look into the Roswell mystery. Stanton Friedman is a nuclear physicist. He graduated from the University of Chicago in the same graduating class as Carl Sagan. He is renowned as an expert not only on nuclear physics and potential propulsion methods that would involve nuclear power for spacecraft and the like, but he is also, of course, best known perhaps for his work on UFOs. He's the author of books that include Flying Saucers and Science, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill Abduction Story, and a number of other books. And then actually another book that we discuss in this interview, which you're about to hear, my friends, was Science is Wrong, okay? Or Science Was Wrong, actually, is the name of the book. And we get into this quite heavily during this conversation, because there is this attitude that really drives me insane in mainstream science these days, that we already know everything, and therefore there's no reason to look at UFOs or anything else for that matter, with a serious eye, because of the cult of science that we are faced with by the academic mainstream. It's really sad. And Stanton addressed that in his book, Science Was Wrong, and he also addresses that in this interview. So for your listening entertainment, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Stanton Friedman. Good morning, Stan. How are you? Micah Hanks here.
I'm great, of course.
Great, of course. Hey, that's a good answer. You know, a lot of people, I call them up, and they're like, fine, let's get this over with. So you know that goes. Oh, boy. I'm already looking forward to Sacramento this summer. I'll tell you, I'll take your word, though. I hear it's going to be hot. And I had a friend asking about California and said, what time should I visit California? And I said, well, I don't know, but I know it's going to be hot in the summertime. So any other time.
Well, it depends where you are in California. There's an enormous variation in climate out there. The Bay Area, maybe San Francisco, maybe 75, Berkeley, 85. 50 miles east of there, 95, and Sacramento, 105.
Yeah, sounds like you've been out there a lot more than me.
I lived there for 14 years.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. See, I didn't know I was interviewing a climatological expert this morning as well. But then again, Stan, I know that you're pretty much the man about town when it comes to knowing stuff. So that works for me.
I'm an old guy who's lived in a lot of places, is what it boils down to.
Oh, goodness. Well, without further ado, I won't take up too much of your time today, my friend. Thanks for doing this. I think, so Stan, what's been going on in the world of UFOs with you lately? Anything new?
Well, yeah, one bit of news. Over a year ago, I signed an option agreement with Stellar Productions for movie rights to my book, Top Secret Magic, my life story, you know, my sixth grandchild, whatever. And they also signed one with an agreement on the book Witness to Roswell by Don Schmidt. And they combined these into an exciting, dynamic movie, you know, All the President's Men about UFOs or something like that.
Wow.
And then just a little over a week ago, same company bought the movie rights to the book Captured by myself and Kathleen Martin, Betty Hill's niece. It's uh-huh. Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And there's Kathy has the inside story. She's got all the hypnosis tapes, all the correspondence. She was the executor of Betty's estate. She did most of the work, let's face it. But I had met Betty and Barney way back in the 60s, and I was the first to publish about the star map work. So we got a book together, and it's doing quite well. And they want to make a movie out of it. And so... two movies going at once, maybe.
Wow. You know, see, that's how it goes. You do this stuff long enough, and all of a sudden you become a Hollywood guy. And, you know, you mentioned a film that's going to have some to do with Roswell, and then another that's going to have to do with Betty and Barney Hill. There was a famous film that was made. I think it was The Interrupted
yes.
Journey, you know, that was made about
well,
that.
Well, the book was The Interrupted Journey, and the film was The UFO Incident starring James Earl Jones in 1975. And would you believe... I was actually a consultant on that movie. I was living in California, and Universal Studios got my name from the Air Force, of all places.
From the Air Force.
Well, they were supposed to report requests for information to a local scientist, so I fit the bill, you know, I guess. And, yeah, it was an interesting experience, and that movie was seen by a lot of people. It was, you know, well-received, but... remember, it only covered up through the mid-60s, mm-hmm. and the whole point is what happened to Betty's life after that, the whole business of the star map work, the scientific work that went on after that. It's an interesting life story, and the impact and so forth of, you know, here's a social worker who works for the state of New Hampshire. Barney worked for the post office and the Governor's Civil Rights Commission he was on. And their lives surely got turned topsy-turvy. They thought they'd lose their jobs. They couldn't do anything to stop the story coming out. Somebody had taped something they shouldn't have and gave it to a reporter who wanted to interview them. We don't want any interviews. We'll lose our jobs. Well, like, they went to a lawyer. Couldn't stop them.
Yeah.
But so that changed everything. It turned out the book was a bestseller around the world by John Fuller. As a matter of fact, John Fuller and I and Betty and a few other people appeared on a show with David Susskind all together. And the interesting thing happened there, which sets up the problem for many in the media. David says between takes, I read the New York Times, there's nothing there that says these things are real. So we have the Susskind syndrome. I'm somebody who takes very strongly the notion that I should keep up with what's important in the world. And if aliens were visiting, that would be important. But since I... if it were important, I would know about it, and I don't. It must not be true, and I'm not going to waste my time on it. And well, that's a common attitude.
Well, it's perfect logic, isn't it?
and reporters. What? It's what?
I said it's perfect logic, isn't it? Come on, Stan.
Well, sure. You know, ego triumphs over everything. And, you know, Kathy and I did a book together, Science Was Wrong, in which he looked at 14 different cases of smart people saying very stupid things that stood in the way of progress for a long time because the world listens to smart people who may not know anything at all about the topic at hand but have good credentials, you know, about something else.
Oh, absolutely.
And there are consequences to that kind of follow-the-leader mentality. You know, Billy Mitchell said after the First World War, he was a pilot in the First World War, aviation is going to change everything. We're going to be able to sink big ships from airplanes. Secretary of the Navy said, what are you, crazy? I'll stand in the middle of any boat you're going to try to sink. It's a good thing he didn't. but their attitude was very strong. In the end of November 1941, the Army-Navy football game program said, they had a picture of the USS Arizona, and there was a comment in the story that nobody has ever sunk a battleship from the sky. 8 days later was Pearl Harbor.
Oh, man.
And the USS Arizona went to the bottom with 1,100 sailors on board.
That's the kind of attitude, though. You know, we've continuously seen that. I mean, really, since time began.
Yes.
And we always have to end up eating crow a little later on down the road and revising our theories. You know, I remember something, by the way, that was in the old report on unidentified flying objects back in the 1940s, you know, that Ruppelt put out. And he said that at the end of that first edition that, you know, within the next few decades, he was certain that with the innovations that were occurring in technology and the like, that he would be, or maybe that his predecessor, or not predecessors, those that came before him, that would be impossible, wouldn't it? Yeah, his successors would be able to solve the UFO mystery. And yet here we are, decades later, more than half a century later, and we don't really seem to be that much closer to solving.
You know, it's clear. If you look at the evidence and talk to the scientists who have looked at the evidence, it's clear there is no mystery. Aliens are coming here from someplace else. They're doing their thing. Governments are covering it up. It's very simple and straightforward. That's why I wrote the book, Flying Saucers and Science. If you go down the line and look at each question, can you get here from there? Oh, of course not, say the prominent physicist. That's baloney. Yeah, you can't get from Fredericton, New Brunswick, where I live, to California in 6 hours if you're going to walk. But try using an airplane, you know? Magellan took his ship took 3 years. He didn't make it to go around the planet. Then it was around the world in 80 days, and now the space station does it in 90 minutes. Technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. One of the advantages I have in the umpteen years I've been working on UFOs is that I worked on fission nuclear rockets, fusion nuclear rockets, nuclear power plants for space, and I can deal with those arguments. There are other people who say governments can't cover anything up. Dr. Tyson of the Hayden Planetarium, we know that they can't cover things up. Look how much we know about President Clinton's genitalia. Really relevant, but very funny remark, you know. And so it goes. You got to look at the relevant data, and that's why I take on any of these guys, because their whole attitude, there are four basic rules for debunkers. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. And do your research by proclamation. It's much easier than investigation. And so they'll tell you, the SETI people, one of my pet peeves, the silly effort to investigate, I call it, they're not looking for extraterrestrial life. They're looking for radio signals that would have to be sent by somebody stuck at the same level of technology as we are, even though we've only had radio for roughly 110 years. How utterly absurd. I don't use a slide rule anymore.
It is pretty silly, isn't it? You know. Now, but here's the other aspect too, Stan. Now, if we are dealing with a highly advanced extraterrestrial or interdimensional or anything else, if they're not from here and they are not human, then what if there is a technology at play here that is so highly advanced that there are aspects of it that are not even perceptible to humanity? I mean, is that really kind of the base?
Oh, that's not impossible, of course. You know, give Christopher Columbus, hey, Chris, nice job over there in that new discovery of yours. I got an electric and nuclear-powered submarine. I need two more, and I have an unlimited budget. Can you make me a couple? Of course he couldn't. He couldn't even have started. He didn't know anything about nuclei and, you know, all the rest of that. So by its very nature, technological advancement's got to include things that we didn't know before if we had known them, we used them, you know. And so, of course, they could be using techniques far beyond what we know. My point isn't that I know the ultimate secrets of how they work, but that with what we already know, nuclear fusion can get us to the stars. You know, fusion is what makes the energy in all the stars in the universe. Everybody who's an advanced civilization, maybe only a million years ahead of us, after all.
Yeah.
In the Betty and Barney Hill case, those stars, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, they're only a billion years older than the sun, and they're only 39.3 light years away, and they're only an eighth of a light year apart from each other. I would expect they would know some things we don't know.
This is right down the road.
Yeah, and so we don't need to go far out, but let me go back to the nuclear for a minute. In a period of 10 years, we went from 10-ton blockbusters in World War II, took a B-29 to carry them, a bomb, made a nice big hole in the ground. 3 years later, we've got the first atomic bomb, the equivalent of 19,000 tons of TNT as opposed to 10 for the bomb. And 7 years after that, we exploded our first H-bomb, 10 million tons of TNT energy release equivalent, three-mile-wide fireball, if you can imagine that. And the Russians outdid us a few years later, 57 million tons. Now, if you use the right stuff in the right way with nuclear fusion reactors, you can kick particles out the back end of a rocket that only have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. So we know how to get out there. And if I were an alien, I'd be worried about the idiots on this planet.
Yeah.
And I mean that seriously. We killed 50 million of our own kind in World War II. We destroyed 1,700 cities. And the killing hasn't stopped. So we're not nice guys. Nobody would want us to take our brand of friendship, everybody else calls it hostility, out there. You know, so I'm not invoking unobtainium and unknowium. I'm saying with what we know already, if we want to spend the dough. I'm not saying we should. That's a different question.
Well, there is, yeah, undeniably a nuclear component to a lot of these. You know, you and I in the past have talked about the Cash Landrum sighting. Well, it wasn't just a sighting. It was a full-on encounter, and there were absolutely devastating, long-lasting physical repercussions as a result of that because, you know, Betty Cash, of course, ended up eventually suffering a multiple or a multitude of different varieties of cancer as a result of what? Exposure to incredible amounts of radiation in the presence of whatever that aircraft was that she saw. Many have said that it was maybe some sort of a secret government craft, you know, others.
Well, I worked on nuclear airplanes, but it sure doesn't sound like one to me.
Yeah, it didn't sound like anything we know about, right?
No, I mean, maybe it had a problem. I don't know. But, yeah, there are a lot of manifestations of interesting stuff, and nuclear is only one, and what you said before certainly applies. Maybe we will know how to warp space and time. And, you know, stuff like that. I'm not saying there is no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying we don't need to invoke it to say that to get from here someplace else. I mean, people want half an Einstein. Limit is the speed of light. Hey, when you get close to the speed of light, time slows down. So at 99.99% of the speed of light, and particles in the big accelerator at CERN go much faster than that, a bunch more nines. But at just 99.99% of the speed of light, you can go 37 light years in 6 months, pilot time. You go out, come back, marry your granddaughter's best friend. You know, it's the gift of immortality. Yeah, it sounds like fun. So they tend to leave that out very conveniently. So I'm not saying warp space and time. We've had guys in space for 6 months, guys under the water in nuclear-powered submarines. And, you know, many people don't realize, not only do we have nuclear-powered submarines that can go around the world underwater, mm-hmm, without coming to the surface. They take periscope leave at Hawaii, I'm told. We also have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that can operate for 18 years without refueling. Can you imagine that?
It's incredible.
So, you know, when people start saying it's impossible and blah, 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 I say, do your homework, darn it. Read my book.
Read his book. Yeah, that's absolutely. And that now, but which one, Stan? That's the problem. You got so many. I mean, which one do they start with? Flying Saucers and Science, I presume, probably would be a good primer on this sort of thing, right?
That would be a good one. If you don't want to get too technical, you go into Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, or you go into Science Was Wrong, or if you really want to get involved, you go to Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C. The movie will be called Magic Men. All we need now is somebody to pay the money.
That's right, exactly. Pay this man's bills. That's Stan Friedman, ladies and gentlemen, right there. And that, I think, is about everything we'll need for the interview today. Stan, any final thoughts, my friend?
Well, yeah, try my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. It's got the books, the DVDs, everything you always want to know about flying saucers at one convenient location on the web.
Isn't it wonderful? Technology. How do we even keep up with this? Well, one final question, Stan. In the coming years,
sure,
as we continue to have, you know, technological innovations and you know,
yeah,
scary science, you know, achievements continue to bring us closer to, well, literally what we might be seeing flying around out there in the skies, do you think some of these mysteries are going to become, maybe, are they going to come a little closer to home? Are we going to take on a technological ability to better understand some of the UFO mysteries that have been haunting us?
Well, I think we are. And what's scary about that is for many groups on this planet and many countries. That just means figuring out better ways to use them for military purposes, which I don't much admire. And one of the biggest reasons for secrets. Everybody would like to build a better flying system, a weapons delivery and defense systems. Let's do something more than build weapons. You know, we'll spend $1 trillion this year on Earth for things military. And how many thousands of kids die every single day of preventable disease or starvation?
Good point.
We have, you know, we have strange priorities on this planet. So I don't say let's build better military vehicles. Either you learn to live at peace with your neighbor or you don't last for very long. If they're coming here, they've been peaceful, relatively.
Yeah. Amen, brother. Excellent. Well, Stan, always good to talk to you, my friend. You take care of yourself.
My pleasure.
If I don't speak to you sooner, I'll see you out there in California in June. How's that?
I'll be there. Bring your suntan lotion.
That's right. And he was not kidding. And by the way, if you're not aware of what we're talking about there, Stan and I are actually going to both be appearing together as speakers. Anthony Sanchez's conference is going to be in Sacramento, California this June. Okay, it's the Southern California UFO and Paranormal Conference. Really excited about being out there, so you can if you're in the Sacramento area, you can come on out and see Stan and yours truly. Scotty Roberts is going to be there as well, and a number of others. Oh, yeah, and you know what? We're going to lobby to get Chris Hayes and Matt Oakley out there, because I hear that there's a portion of the Hadal contingency out there that is really eager to meet you guys.
Well, we won't be speaking, Matthew and I, but we will be there with press credentials, and we'll cover the whole thing.
I think you guys are going to be my bodyguards,
really,
actually.
Objectively.
I think Chris needs bodyguards, especially after reading this email I just found. It appears that Mike the Hadal has contacted me directly.
What?
Yeah. Get this. This is a harrowing message. But
it speaks to your shortcomings.
Matt, yeah, give us the information, Matt. This sounds important.
It's just addressed Reverend, and it says, "We Hadals pray to you every night, but you have closed your kind eyes to us. Save us, Reverend. We fear he know we listening to his phone calls." So that explains that, Chris. And he fool our princess and many Hadal with his smooth tongue.
You've been fooling the mini Hadal with smooth tongue again.
Well, I mean,
we told you about this.
I know I'm a smooth talker, but I mean, if I'm fooling them with a smooth tongue, that just brings a whole new connotation that I don't even want to get into.
Well, it says you fooled them with your smooth tongue. It says he talk like radio man from the 30s, and he sell us worthless war bonds. What did we tell you about this kind of stuff? This is exactly the kind of...
Go on, read the email,
okay,
Matt.
Okay, it finishes with, "Help us, Reverend Kind Eyes. You are our only hope."
I knew it.
And to address this email, I think Chris and I were talking earlier this evening, and I think we may have to organize a panel debate between Hadal representatives and apparently what's being deemed as the Hollow Earth dictator, Chris Hayes.
Oh, so you're the Hollow Earth dictator now, huh? You're the Hadal Hitler, huh? Look at this guy. You know what? I don't know if I like you that much anymore, buddy.
Oh, there are just so many things I could say. But I would fully appreciate the chance to, you know, defend my actions and you know, try to express how everything I've done with the best interests of the Hadals right here in my heart.
You don't have the best interest of anybody at heart. Look at this guy. You don't even have a heart. You're a zombie. But anyway.
No, that means I don't have a soul.
Oh, well, then, oh ye soulless one. You know, we will be speaking with a very soulful individual in the next hour. Dr. Rita Louise will be joining us here on the Graylian Report, but we'll have news of the strange when we come back right after this. Stay tuned, my friends. It is the Graylian Report.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by: never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind. Ever. Learn more about what we do at woundedwarriorproject.org.
Back to the program. There's some of that in-house music I was talking about. The talent of Mr. Caleb Hanks and his insomnia. You know, we joked about, you know, if Caleb were to start doing DJing, that he could call himself DJ Transhuman. Get it? DJ Transhuman. Anyway. It is the Graylian Report. Welcome back. If you really like this show, let us know. Email us, info@graylianreport.com. The other ways you can like this program, you can actually go on Facebook and like us there. We've got that linked to the website, www.graylienreport.com, where you can learn other ways you can like the show. I really like you. In fact, I'm not just saying that. Learning to like someone may be as easy as just saying the words, I really like you. In fact, Scientific American wrote about this recently in their March 2012 issue, saying, if you are fond of someone, okay, or rather, if you're not fond of someone even, but you say that you are, it might actually make you like that person. According to a study in the October 2011 issue of the Journal of Experimental Psychology and Animal Behavior Processes, there are psychologists who now believe that a study among 39 students shows that a series of photographs that people who had been previously judged as neither pleasant nor unpleasant, okay, after participants were instructed to say the word likable or unlikable after viewing each one, resulted in people actually liking more often individuals that they had no, you know, preconceived notions about prior to viewing these photographs. It was very interesting. They said that they feel like they liked people 17 Or rather, the study showed that they liked people 17% more often when they had previously been told to say likable compared with when they had been told to say unlikable. The study used a method that has been shown to circumvent any conscious memories of which image went into which label. The subjects truly seemed to feel more warmly toward those that they were told to call likable. The results are something to consider the next time you politely say that you like your boring dinner date or noisy office mate.
So is this kind of like lending scientific credence to the old saying, if you say a lie enough times, you'll start believing it?
Apparently so. Because, you know, they say, well, okay, let's bring another axiom to the table. G.I. Joe, knowing is half the battle. Well, apparently saying is half the lie, which is half the belief. Interesting, huh? So if you say that you like someone, you may actually be more likely to like that person. Very interesting. But maybe you could work that to your advantage. You know, maybe when it comes down to getting to know people in the workplace, maybe getting to know people a little better really just comes down to being able to, to convince yourself and learn better ways, rather, to convince yourself that you like an individual.
I wonder if you can reverse engineer that, and somehow, if you tell someone that they like you enough, they will.
That would be interesting. If there were some way that you could train...
There you go again.
You got to trick someone into telling you that they like you, though, for that to work. You know, I know that there's one guy who that's going to be very difficult for. Have you seen this one about the NASA specialist who was axed over his belief in intelligent design? Chris, this would be of interest to you. It was in Los Angeles. A computer specialist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, okay, which is, of course, co-founded by L. Ron Hubbard's old buddy Jack Parsons, remember? Yeah. Well, anyway, a computer specialist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, is going to court now over allegations he was wrongfully terminated, get this, because of his belief in intelligent design. Opening statements in the lawsuit by David Coppedge were expected to start Tuesday morning in Los Angeles Superior Court. And lawyers spent Monday arguing several motions. Coppedge, who worked as a team lead on the Cassini mission exploring Saturn and its many moons, claims that, get this, he claims he was discriminated against because he engaged his co-workers in conversations about intelligent design and handed out DVDs on the idea while at work. Now, maybe that was taking it a step or two too far. Now, to each his own. But you know, I'm very careful about, you know, I don't hand out CDs of the Graylian Report to people at the office. Of course, they all listen to the Graylian Report. They all wish that, you know, that they didn't have to listen to the program as often as they do, in fact.
Well, there are a few points I'd like to bring up about this. One being, you know, you say it's something of particular interest to me, and it kind of is, but you know what? Believe what you want. I don't believe what I don't want to believe. You believe what you want to believe. That's fine.
Right.
But once you start proselytizing in the workplace, that's when I do feel like, yes, you are eligible to be reprimanded. The second he handed out those DVDs was the second he was, you know, putting himself on the chopping block, and I feel no remorse for that. However, along the lines of intelligent design, there was a huge hubbub over the Ben Stein movie, Expelled, that he made regarding the firings and the professors losing their tenure over professing, you know, intelligent design in the classroom. And I fully support that because it's not, you know, it's not verified or backed up by science whatsoever, so they shouldn't be teaching it as science, especially at the university level. So I feel like that is a completely appropriate punishment for them to lose their tenure and their jobs.
Right. For those who aren't familiar with what we're discussing, by the way, when we say intelligent design, I'm sure most people do, but that is the belief that some higher power likely had a hand in the creation of the universe and the cosmos. And because life itself is too complex, it, in all likelihood, could not have been developed through a process, for instance, such as Darwinistic evolution by itself. Now, Coppedge, this individual from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, he lost his team lead title in 2009 and then was let go last year after 15 years on the mission. In an emailed statement, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory dismissed Coppedge's claims. In court papers, lawyers for the California Institute of Technology, which manages JPL for NASA, said Coppedge received a written warning because his co-workers complained of harassment.
Well, there you go. That's all it takes. And I can give you a little story of, you know, where I used to work when I had a 9-to-5 working at a, you know, for a health insurance company that shall remain nameless. There was a big hubbub over pro-religious shirts, which, you know what, I don't care. We all know my stance, and we all know I'm not going to, like, go on the battlefield to, you know, defend what I believe.
Sure.
But people were wearing their, you know, washed in the blood, all those weird shirts. And one woman was handing out religious tracts to all of, but specifically one, of the gay people at work. And she didn't really get in any trouble at all. She was moved away from the person she was sitting next to, and that was it. So I decided, you know, if they can wear their business shirts, that I would wear one of my shirts, which, you know, is completely inoffensive.
Oh boy.
It's just a white shirt with a red A, and on the back it says "Atheists out of the closet."
Oh, okay.
That's all it says. It doesn't say, you know, Jesus is stupid or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It was just "Atheists out of the closet." I got in trouble.
You did?
I did. Because some of the people who are religious said it was offensive.
Hmm.
So when I tried to pull the, well, their Jesus shirts are offending me, it didn't
But were
out.
Their Jesus shirts really offending you?
No.
Exactly. See, that's the point.
But see, my shirt was completely inoffensive. Their shirt had blood. Come on.
Well, I'll tell you this. You know, before Chris says something that doesn't need to go out over the airwaves. No, I'm kidding.
Right. I'm not going to say anything.
This guy's really careful about that sort of thing. I know you are. But no, in truth, you know, I think the trick is that we need to be sensitive to one another. We need to be sensitive to each other's beliefs. And that's the thing. And you know, yes, the blood is a part of the Christian interpretation of the Christ, and the deification and all this. But the thing is I think that, you know, there's a way to go about it respectfully in the workplace. When we come back, we'll be talking with Rita Louise here on the Graylian Report. Stay tuned.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
Welcome back to the program. It is the second hour of this week's edition of the Graylian Report. Yes, whether you believe that we are here by mere catastrophic, cataclysmic, and chaotic chance, or if there is indeed intelligent design, I'll tell you. I'm actually one of the proponents of the intelligent design theory. I think that it is rather bold of us just to think that we know everything about the universe. But what actually may be out there? Gods, angels, aliens? You know, I don't profess to know. But as was the case with the gentleman in the last hour, yes, indeed, maybe, just maybe, we need to be sensitive to others and their beliefs as we go about these things, especially in the workplace. But there can't be double standards. We have to be sensitive to all persons, all creeds, all belief systems. That's something we also try and respect here on the Graylian Report, which is why we have we've got a reverend right here with kind eyes. We've got a zombie atheist, and then we've got a universal spiritualist who was raised a Christian whose father is an Episcopal priest. And that's your host, by the way, Mr. Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South. Always keeping you company here. Every Tuesday night from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time on the Graylian Report. You know, last I heard, although right now, since they're in a different time zone, Mississippi and Alabama, their polls are going to be closing. Actually, they would have closed just about an hour ago, I suppose. So that information is going to still be coming in. DrudgeReport.com has got Fight for the South up on the main page right now, and they're getting results for a number of the southern states right now, where it is expected Mitt Romney will be leading. But that's all we have to say about that, as Forrest Gump put it, I think. here in a moment are going to be joined by Miss Rita Louise, who will be joining us to discuss her practice as a psychic doctor. I think this is going to be a very fascinating, very fascinating story. But I did want to touch on pardon me, one more thing here. Before we get to that, we have a lot of stories that we're going to be touching on tonight. And have you guys seen this one? This one really, I just don't know what to make of this. That they are there's this story. The title reads "Turning Homeless People into Wi-Fi Hotspots." Have you seen this? I couldn't make this stuff up.
No, but I support it.
Okay, according to the New York Times, okay, here's the deal. They say that there was a project called Homeless Hotspots, in which a marketing company decided that they would help out by helping the homeless and promoting itself. Homeless people have been enlisted, get this, to roam the streets wearing T-shirts that say, "I am a 4G hotspot," and passersby can pay what they wish to get online via the 4G to Wi-Fi service that the people are carrying via a device on their person. You know, I guess that that may give a new task to some of the to some of the homeless individuals involved in these projects. It may also give them a more constructive role to play in society. But something about that seems a little weird too, doesn't it?
You know, not only does it seem kind of exploitative, but it just seems like panhandling times 10, because you know, now you've got, you know, the people wearing the I'm a 4G hotspot, and you can pay what you like. That phrase, you can pay what you like to get on the network. Well, what if the homeless person doesn't like that you only gave them a dollar and says, well, it's $5?
See, that's what I was unclear about. Are they paying for service, or are they giving money to the homeless person and then allowing the person to utilize Wi-Fi services for a donation to that individual? You know,
and also, I mean, you know, I really hate being the negative one all the time.
Oh, go ahead, Chris.
But it just seems like a way for, you know, homeless people who, not every homeless person is a crackhead, drug addict, drunk.
Absolutely not.
But from my experience in our small / big town, 90% of them are.
You know, there is a...
And you can only extrapolate that to larger populations.
Yes, and so there are a number of issues that should be addressed. Now, I don't know, I can't speak to it. You know, they say in this article, there was a bit of commentary that was provided by the website, how do you pronounce this? I guess it's uprox.com, that's UPROXX, the culture of what's buzzing. What they call themselves. And they ask, so does this mean one has to actually stand next to a stinky homeless person in order to use a homeless person Wi-Fi hotspot? Ugh, gross. No wonder some people think and then they use some sort of nomenclature that I don't understand. But anyway, point is it exploitative, or is it giving these people a sense of self and a sense of purpose and an actual job to perform? I'm not certain, really. And where the boundary between what is good and what is potentially, again, exploitative is crossed, you know? I don't know that, you know, again, reading the story, maybe I'm just not getting all the details, but I feel a little uncomfortable about it.
Well, what I think a better idea, instead of paying people directly, which is what it sounds like what is happening, instead of paying people directly, you create a password for this roving hotspot, and you pay online to a foundation that uses that money, you know, to maintain the servers, but also uses a portion of that money for a job or for, you know, an occupational education program to take in homeless people and teach them, you know, how to succeed in job interviews, how to dress for job interviews, and, you know, how to cope in the workplace after being out of it for so long, and actually help instead of just giving money directly to people who probably won't use it as wisely as they should.
Right, absolutely.
And my whole thing is to address your question. I don't feel it's exploitative at all of these people, because obviously they're grown human beings and they can make their own decisions, so, you know, why the hell not let them walk around in a shirt? My question is, really, do you think this is going to be as successful of a campaign as, I guess, this charity or company hopes it will be? Because I gotta be honest, as much time as I personally spend in, again, the nightlife scene of our small / big town, you notice the majority of people just turn the other way when a homeless person comes walking up.
Right. When the guys mention our small / large town, they're talking about Asheville, North Carolina, for those of you who may be having difficulty visualizing Hadalopolis. Okay. But let me point out also, Matt, no, this isn't any kind of a charity. This is what they call a comically named tech marketing firm, Bartle, Bogle, and Hegarty. And they've come up with a solution to problems of both panhandlers pestering people and also, you know, the obvious issue of homeless individuals.
So now they're going to pester them for more than small change and be like, hey, give me $10 and you can get on Facebook.
Yeah, exactly.
They're
going to be pestering them about other things, or people just are going to totally disregard them altogether, in my opinion.
Well, I'll just tell you this. I'm surprised that this hasn't become more controversial an issue than we expected. You know, I'm very surprised that this hasn't been that this hasn't garnered more attention and become more, you know, controversial with all the kinds of stuff going on there. Then again, it is a political year, and so I guess that in a political year it can tend to be a little difficult, you know, to get attention, even if it's something entirely and incredibly controversial like that. But whatever the case may be, I'm sure that this is going to be garnering some attention here before too long, if it hasn't already. I've seen it on a number of the news sites, so I'm just throwing it out there. I thought it was kind of interesting. It's not paranormal or particularly weird news. Well, yeah, it is pretty weird. Some people may think it's a good thing. I just don't know that you know, all the questions have necessarily been answered just yet. So we'll keep an eye on that one. And if you have feelings about it, you know, you're welcome to touch base with us just as well. You can reach us info@graylianreport.com. Let us know your thoughts. Is it a good idea to arm the homeless with Wi-Fi connectivity and send them out into the streets in order to connect with people so that people can connect to 4G wireless networks and presumably pay to do so? You know, it's a definitely a sort of strange circumstance, but well
and I want to know how that's going to work. Even like, are they going to wear routers around their necks, or like, are they going to have routers, or what's going to wirelessly enable them?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering too. I mean, because apparently they have some sort of a I don't know what you would even call this. I mean, there's some
apparatus.
They have some sort of an apparatus that is obviously wireless itself, which is a 4G wireless, I guess, would you call it a router? I mean, I thought a router had to be hooked up to some sort of a line or something like that. You know, maybe not if it's a wireless router, but the thing is that it's a wireless router that is both receiving information and also allowing people connectivity, and they can walk around and wearing a little backpack, you know.
That just leads into so many questions because, you know, they've got these little, you know, whatever. We'll call them backpacks. They've got these wireless backpacks. A, where are they getting them? B, are they going to have to turn them in at the end of the day or the end of the quarter or the end of whatever? C, how do you know they're not going to get broken? D, how do you know they're not going to get sold? And, if you've got the system set up where you come in the morning, you get the backpack, people pay you, you return the backpack, why don't we just give these people jobs? Like, yeah. I'm sure there's a way to actually give them a job and not make them panhandle legally. Because that just does wonders for, you know, your self-image.
Well, you know, that's the thing. You know, in other words, yes, we know that we've got to try and, arm the homeless with a way that they can provide for themselves. But I think that the situation also is such that, that we also have to find the best means for providing for these individuals. That's, I think, the thing. If we cannot provide for these individuals in a way that is, you know, both suitable for society and also suitable for them, then maybe we should think about it and do it in a way that, again, whether or not it is indeed intended to be or comes across as being exploitative, we should do it in a way that will not be in any circumstance perceived as such. And I feel like in this instance there are a lot of questions that seem to linger. When we come back, we'll have questions for Dr. Rita Louise, our guest tonight on the Graylian Report. She'll be discussing psychic intuitive abilities in the medical practice here on the Graylian Report. Micah Hanks of the Graylian Report here. Today I want to talk to you about Intrepid Magazine, the new leader in clear and reasoned thinking in an unpredictable world, and the official magazine of the Graylian Report. Intrepid features the latest in-depth analysis of science, culture, conspiracy, politics, and unexplained phenomena. You'll get expert commentary from an incredible cast of seasoned writers and researchers, as well as interviews and insights from some of the biggest names in the field. And best of all, you can subscribe today for just $14.95. It's Intrepid Magazine, boldly going. Subscribe today by visiting IntrepidMag.com, and coming soon, look for Intrepid on Nook and Kindle e-readers. Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report, probing the weirdness, cultural misfits in our own right, who broadcast every Tuesday evening from the Hollow Earth.
You and this probing stuff.
I'll learn one day when I'm at.
Yeah.
But anyway, that said, you know, we've been discussing some social issues for the first segment of this hour. Now we'll move along to our very special guest who's joining us tonight here on the Graylian Report. And, of course, I'll tell you just a little bit about our fantastic guest here in just a moment. But I do want to also say, if you aren't already a subscriber, you should check out Intrepid Magazine, the official magazine of the Graylian Report. You can learn about that at intrepidmag.com. And while you're there, stop by, check out the blog, because the blog for the site is, it's an all-new feature there at the website, and it's an, you know, a medium by which you can get interactive with bloggers and authors for the magazine. You'll see guys like myself blogging there, in addition to Scotty Roberts, Nick Redfern, and a host of other incredible writers. Speaking of incredible, soul healer Dr. Rita Louise, Ph.D., N.D., is the founder of the Institute of Applied Energetics, and she's also the host of Just Energy Radio. She is a naturopathic physician and a 20-year veteran in the human potential field. It is her unique gift as a medical intuitive and clairvoyant that illuminates and enlivens her work. She's author of books that include Dark Angels, An Insider's Guide to Ghosts, Spirits, and Attached Entities, Avoiding the Cosmic 2x4, and The Power Within. Dr. Louise credits her early childhood influences for the direction her life would take. We're very pleased to have her joining us tonight on the program, and we hope that the direction of her life will influence us this evening on the program. Welcome to the program, Dr. Louise.
Hi, Micah. Thanks for having me on. I'm really looking forward to spending some time with you and your listeners.
Well, we're looking forward to spending some time with you tonight, and so without further ado, you know, I'll jump into this. I know that you got into this at an early age, so for those who aren't familiar with your work, tell us a little bit about how you came into the kind of practical mediumship that you utilize in your field today.
Okay, so there was The Amazing Kreskin, and then there was another show called The Sixth Sense, so not the movie, even though that would put me in much more current time, that was about a college professor who had ESP, and he was really cool because he would go to places and he would like touch something and he would see the spirit of the possessed person floating around the room, and I thought that was so freaking cool. I wanted to do that. So I started reading books about ESP, which is right next to the witchcraft section, which I went to Catholic school. You couldn't do the witchcraft part. and kept reading books, got into personal growth, tarot, astrology, numerology, you know, Carlos Castaneda, Ram Dass. I mean, you know, all the names that were out there at the time. I mean, the field has changed so much since then. And I knew one of the things that I learned was that if you had become enlightened, you would have ESP as a byproduct. And so I knew I was more enlightened than my friends, but I still didn't have this ESP thing, or psychic abilities is what they call it now. And so I actually found the Berkeley Psychic Institute and started studying with them. And after being in their program for 3 weeks, I had a very incredible experience, discovered that I had been extremely psychic my whole life, but no one ever said, well, when you guess what you're getting for Christmas and you actually get that, you're having a psychic experience. Or if you can see people's past lives, you're having a psychic experience. Or if you know dead people are hanging around, you're having a psychic experience. I didn't know. I thought everybody did that.
So it was kind of news to you. You know, Rita, that said, if someone out there in the listening audience were listening to this right now, and they were not aware whether or not they were perhaps, you know, a psychic intuitive, what kind of things would they need to look for in order to recognize their own abilities?
That's a great question. Well, one of the things that I tell people, and it's just so simple, and people have psychic experiences every day. I mean, there are very few people that are just, all right, I only know one person, and that's the woman who is in charge of the paranormal group that I investigate with. You can take her into the spookiest, most ghost-infested house, and she feels nothing, sees nothing, nothing. But anyway, other than her, everybody else has psychic experiences. And the simplest way I tell people is look at things in hindsight. So if when you get up in the morning, you think to yourself, you get this little thought that says, well, maybe I should take a sweater. And you look outside and it's a beautiful sunny day. And you're like, nah, you know, I don't need a sweater. And then you get to the office and they have the air conditioner turned down to 2 degrees. You know?
Oh, yeah.
You sit there and you say to yourself, God, I should have listened to myself.
Uh-huh.
What actually happened? You were having a psych. You were getting the information that you should be doing something. And okay, you didn't listen to yourself. And I know my example is very simplistic, but I think people can look at a lot of different situations that they have in their lives where they get this thought and then, you know, smack themselves in the top of the head and think, you know, I could have had a V8.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that a lot of people are out there having psychic experiences and are not aware of it. You know, mm-hmm. Or if they aren't having the experiences already, they may be people who are, maybe they aren't naturally by birth predisposed for having those experiences, but not that that they also couldn't learn. You know, I know there's a psychic we've had on the program named Robert Cracknell from England who has said that anyone literally can develop these kind of abilities. Do you share that sentiment, and that do you think that everyone literally can, if they don't already have these abilities, they can learn to harness these things and actually get better at it themselves?
Somebody gave me an example, and I told them that I was stealing it, and I still use it. You know, everybody knows how to draw. You know, when I draw, I have, you know, like my little stick figures with my little stick house with the little stick smoke that comes out the top, because I'm not that good at drawing. But if I took a drawing class, I'm sure my drawing abilities would get better. And it's the same thing with psychic abilities. It's like everybody has this ability. Some people are going to be better at it. I mean, there's my drawing ability, and then there's Michelangelo. You know, I mean, they're totally on the opposite ends of the spectrum. And so obviously there are going to be people that are going to excel in this field, and people maybe not so much. And this whole big range in the middle. Like I said, I've only ever met one person that I have put into environments that they should be picking up stuff, and they haven't. And I can't explain to you why. Everybody else will feel something. They will sense something. You know, their skin will start crawling on their arms and, you know, something. They will have something happen. And it's just fact. You know, it's not even to me conjecture anymore. It's just like a part of my factual life. It's not even a belief.
Rita, do you, you know, when you, and I hear so many others describe it on similar terms, where they feel that it is so much a part of their life that it is, at times, maybe even difficult for them to relate to others on terms, you know, that are apart from maybe an intuitive interpretation of what's going on around them. Are you able to sense intuition from people maybe who haven't actually, you know, tapped into that? I mean, I'll give you an example. For years and years, I've always been a very skeptical person who never had experiences along those lines, psychic by nature, of my own. But after a while, you know, I kept having my own personal experiences with psychics who would say, oh, you're off the chart. You have all kinds of abilities. And I'm like, yeah, uh-huh, okay, whatever. And then eventually, you know, I did start having, you know, things happen. I don't know that I would call myself a psychic, but I surely began having some incredible synchronicities, some serendipitous experiences that I couldn't explain. Can you pick it up off of other people when they have that, even if they don't know it?
Yes, I mean, because, you know, our bodies are, you know, there's the physical body and then there's the energetic body. And in the energetic body, there are structures that are called chakras that process information from the world around us. And their job is to open and close based on how much information we are bringing through. So as an example, when we are in fear, which is associated with the first chakra, which is at the base of the spine, that chakra will close up. And so as an example, someone that's in survival, you know, like they might lose their job, you know, there's something in a financial area. What's the first thing that will usually happen? They stop spending. They shut that chakra down and not a thing is going to go through. Well, there are chakras that are associated with our ability to send, receive, and assimilate energy from the world around us. Emotional energy, audio energy, visual information. And you can look at those chakras and see how much information the person, one, processes through it, and two, how much they recognize what they're receiving. And so when you put those two questions together, you can usually identify how much the there are a lot of people that receive a lot of information, but they just don't pay attention to it, you know, and it just whoosh, goes by. And I'll bet in your case, you were receiving a lot of information, but you just never connected the dots.
Maybe so.
Like me.
Maybe so. And it's that ongoing, you know, I hesitate to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway, this rite of passage, this learning to perceive what may already be coming along to you. I believe our producer, Chris Hayes, has a question as well. Go ahead, Chris.
Yes. Hi, Rita. It's Chris.
Hi, Chris.
I have a question, actually. I'm not sure how much you know about all of us, but I'm uber skeptical about pretty much everything. And we've got a thing going on called Project Believer involving me. And I was wondering, for people who are, dare I say, who willfully disbelieve in things like this, do you believe that there are experiences that are so strong and so, you know, in your face that even people who, you know, go out of their way to be skeptics, you know, can't ignore it?
Can't ignore it. You know, I'm going to say, and this is going to sound really bad, no. And I have a very specific reason, because you can have these uber experiences and then just write them off. Can I share a quick story with you about that?
Yes, please.
So I was in my early 20s, and I was still wanting to be psychic. Actually, I'm not even sure if I was 20. And I was working at a company, and I was a drafter at the time, and in the room next to me was this lab, and there was this older guy and his lab assistant, who was my age, and he and I used to like run up and down the halls, and we were just crazy together. And so every day, well, to make a longer story short, so one day the manager didn't come into work. And so the following day, I went into the office to, you know, do my little morning highs, and I went over to say hi to him. And he had like the comb over thing going on, and he had this little round Band-Aid on the top of his head. And I kind of have a very weird imagination, but my cognitive brain said, well, he must have a zit up there that's kind of gross and pussy. And so he put the Band-Aid on the top of his head. That's what's going through my head. I walked up to the man, looked him straight in the face, crossed my arms, and looked at him and said, well, where were you yesterday having them check for a brain tumor?
Oh, no.
His face turned white. He walked out of the room. Every hair on my body was standing on end. I was shaking, literally shaking. I had no idea what happened. The assistant came and was yelling at me because his boss thought that he had told me where he had been. And I'm like, where was he? It's like, anyone's having them check for a brain tumor.
Oh, wow.
I never connected that with having a psychic experience until 15 years later.
You know, and I've had experiences kind of like that, not, you know, as extreme as what you've had, and I've always, you know, written them off as coincidence or supreme bad luck. And I wanted to, you know, just say that I'm not one of the, you know, the willful disbelievers. I'm really skeptical about a lot of things, but part of Project Believer is I'm open to everything as long as it's, you know, as long as it's not something I can explain away with, you know, logic or science, I'm open to everything, and I want to believe. It's just nothing has convinced me so far.
And I think one of the things, especially with trusting your intuition or believing that you're psychic, which I think those two words are synonymous, is through repetition. It's not through any particular experience. It's through the consistently having an experience and having what you're getting being right.
Well, I'll have to keep that in mind, because I feel like maybe it's one of those things where not so much I'm ignoring it, but I just don't know it's happening until after the fact.
But that's okay. After the fact is okay, as long as you go, that could have been a psychic experience. You know, if you just change the word and open yourself up to validating that it wasn't just a coincidence, that maybe, just maybe, Chris, you are having a psychic experience.
So, Chris, you're the latest among us, perhaps, to come to the fold. And here we thought Chris was, engaging in this Project Believer. Maybe he'll be a believer before it's all said and done.
Well, and, a lot of my stuff has been pretty insignificant. Not, anything profound.
Yeah, just downplay it.
But are you talking about stuff that you receive about yourself or stuff that you receive from about other people?
Not even about other people, just in general. Like, as an example, and this could be a complete, fluke of coincidence, which, I put it down to. The other day, I picked up, out of the blue, Hunter S. Thompson's The Great Shark Hunt and started reading it. 20 minutes later, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas came on, and little things like that have happened all the time. Anytime I get interested in something like, say, the Civil War, the History Channel, a few days later, will run, unbeknownst to me, a week-long Civil War series.
See, I call that synchronicity. What's your idea about that, Rita?
A lot of people want to become psychic so that they can know their own future. And really, accessing information for yourself is the hardest thing to do. It is the hardest. And usually it comes to us in prompts. It's a book that we see that we're drawn to. It is just some weird synchronistic thing, but it's what wants to take us on our path. And so when you're talking about being psychic for yourself, it's not like, hey, Chris, you need to go do this thing. I mean, it so doesn't work that way. It's much easier to do a reading for a third party than it is to get out of judgment about yourself and access your own information. So when you're doing stuff for yourself, it's more about, this feels right, kind of using that feeling barometer. Well, this feels good. Well, this feels like the right direction. Well, no, can you guys, and I'm just going to throw a question back, can you guys tell the difference between when you're making a mental cognitive decision versus making a decision because it feels like the right thing to do or the right direction to head? You see where I'm making a distinction here?
Yeah, I think so.
When you're going with the more feeling and that direction, you're tapping into your soul energy and actually allowing God's spirit, your higher self, lead the way. When you're going on a more cognitive level, it's your brain. Usually if you listen to your brain, you get hosed every time.
That's a good way of putting it. Now, I have a question. When it comes to the use of medical intuition and intuitive counseling, which is what you do, how does that process and that process of discernment in the utilization of practical mediumship, how does that play into utilizing that for intuitive counseling?
Okay, well, one, and let me just be clear, I'm not a medium. Don't claim to be a medium. I mean, because when you refer to someone being a medium, they talk to dead people. I don't talk to dead people. I really enjoy dealing with the living, even though I do ghost hunting, but it's different.
Oh, you should meet Chris then, because he's a zombie, yes.
Oh, well, cool. And so, a medical intuitive is a psychic that talks to you about your health. Okay. And one of the things that I learned early on in working with clients was that it was very obvious to me their health issues. And the more I learned about health and about healing, the more information just came through me. It's kind of like, I had like all of these past lives as healers, and it just is a very natural experience. Just like someone who talks to dead people, it's a very natural experience for them to bring these people through, or people that channel. I don't channel either. It's just a very natural experience. And so for me, working with people on their health concerns, physical, mental, and emotional, I don't know. Everybody has their own thing, I play the cello while somebody else might play the piccolo.
Do you actually play the cello, by the way?
No.
Oh, I love the cello. That's why I asked.
Maybe I was having a psychic experience on you.
Maybe you were. Maybe you were reading my mind. As I understand, there is a board for the International Association of Medical Intuitives. You are the chairman of this board. In other words, I'm taking it that there are a lot of people out there like yourself who are what they call medical intuitives. Am I correct?
That's correct. And, medical intuition, I think, really needs to come forward more. Not as a practice, or maybe the medical community would, if they would accepting this as a diagnostic tool. I believe medical intuition is a diagnostic tool, kind of like getting an x-ray or a CAT scan. Because if you can look into a person's body and go, this doesn't really look like an infection, it looks more like this, or, your disc isn't out, you have just this really bad muscle sprain, and you can give direction, give guidance to help. A lot of the people that I work with have gone the medical routes, and the doctors are like, well, we don't know. You're not dead. Your blood work looks okay, so come back in 6 months.
Interesting. We're talking with Dr. Rita Louise, who discusses medical intuition and energy medicine training and a host of other subjects. Who knows? For all we know, we all may individually be gifted in some capacity or another with medical intuition. That's what we're at least hoping to learn from tonight's discussion. She is the psychic doctor, and she's joining us tonight on the Grayley Report as our guest. When we come back from this break, we will continue our discussion with Dr. Rita Louise, and I hope to ask her a few interesting questions with regard to this interesting area of subtle energy work and science. In fact, I think we're going to get a little bit into the realm of how a person might get into involving themselves and learning about energy work themselves. That with Dr. Rita Louise when we come back here on the Graylian Report. As a parent, you can't help but look at your child and wonder what the future holds. You may dream about the possibility of your son or daughter becoming a professional athlete or a renowned heart surgeon. But while you're dreaming, consider this. The odds that your child will be diagnosed with autism are 1 in 110. Knowing the signs of autism and getting an early diagnosis could make a world of difference to your child and to you. To learn the signs, visit AutismSpeaks.org, brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Back to the Graylian Report. Tonight's edition of the program, we're featuring the psychic doctor, Rita Louise. She's discussing medical intuition and energy, medicine training, a host of different things. Her website is soulhealer.com. You can learn more about her work by visiting that URL. And we'll also have her toss out other ways that the listenership can learn about Dr. Rita and her work later in the program. But continuing our conversation, we've got a few minutes left here, and Chris, I think you had a question you wanted to jump in there with again, real quick, for Dr. Rita.
I do. Well, two. One is more just website related and one is functional. Dr. Rita, as far as when I Googled medical intuitives, I got a ridiculous number of results. But so I want to know, as far as the board that you're a part of, what is the website for your board?
It is www.medical-intuitives.net.
Awesome. I just want to say I got that right the first time.
Psychic.
He is psychic, I know it.
But another thing I wanted to ask is more, you know, really a syntax issue or a verbiage issue. Do you feel like... I've always wanted to know if, you know, people who are intuitives or call themselves psychics, if you feel like the word or term psychic does a disservice to what it is you actually do. Because I like to think of, you know, intuitives like Robert Cracknell and yourself as more of, you know, trained deductive scientists. Like, you know, you're using your power of deduction and induction consciously versus... what I feel like the term psychic denotes is something being done to you versus something you're doing yourself.
Or maybe something you have no control over, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think the word psychic, you know, it is such a far-reaching umbrella, you know, and there are people that call themselves psychics because they have memorized the Tarot book and will reiterate what the book says to you by throwing Tarot cards down. And to me, that's not psychic. You know, you're just repeating stuff. No offense to anybody out there doing that, but, you know, but it's true. You know, but I mean, I used to tell people earlier when I first started that I was Rita the Psychic Chick because I wanted to talk to you about your relationships and gossip a lot. So that was kind of fun. But now I'm Dr. Rita the Medical Intuitive. So it's different. But even on my own marketing stuff, you know, I market myself as a medical intuitive and as a clairvoyant because I think the word psychic just has a bad rap. I mean, it's not that people that are psychics are bad, but I think, you know, it's just kind of overused and misunderstood.
Yeah, the associations that society as a whole makes with the word psychic versus even clairvoyant and intuitive are just vastly different.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually have a question from the chat room. One of our listeners asks, as far as how your medical intuition works, like specifically, like how it is that you work with your clients, what it is you do. If you could give, you know, a step by step walkthrough.
Okay, so there are two different ways that I'll work with clients. One is I will. See, and people kind of get on me for this one, is we'll go through your body and assess what's going on. I'll just be upfront. For me to do a full-blown assessment, it takes me an hour to an hour and a half. I find that most people, when they call because they want to have a session, they already know where their owies are. And so if you tell me, my hip hurts, I'm having a hard time breathing, you know, I have this refluxy kind of thing going on, we save a lot of time and we can spend time in the session actually going into what is actually causing you to have the reflux or whatever, you know, the symptom is that you're experiencing. My primary way of dealing with things is that I'm a clairvoyant, which means I look at things, and so I will look for inflammation, irritation, dysfunction. You know, I because I'm a naturopath, I know a lot of questions to internalize. To, you know, if you're complaining about reflux, well, what's going on with your liver and gallbladder? Is there something going on with your stomach? You know, do you have enough stomach acid? I mean, there's a lot of things that I will automatically go and start looking at. But as part of the session, I firmly believe that emotional, psycho-spiritual situations can affect our health and will usually underlie a health issue. And so I will also go into, you know, what the psycho-spiritual aspect of their disease is. And in my sessions, I do provide a certain level of recommendation, although I'm not really big on putting people on long-term protocols, and I don't believe in giving someone like $500 worth of supplements to take when they leave my office. I mean, I just right. don't believe in that philosophy, personally.
You train others in courses where they can kind of take their own healing
and by virtue of their own healing and learning to heal, they can take their personal growth to a new level, and they can find ways to not only improve themselves.
I mean, not just in healing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I offer a training where, you know, your listeners can actually learn how to be a medical intuitive. Actually, there are three levels. There's an energy medicine practitioner level. There's a intuitive counselor, which is you'd be a psychic. Or the medical intuition, which would be the highest level. And it is, I tell people it's a professional level training. So it's not like you go to a 150-hour class and you kind of do things once and then they're like, bye-bye, you know, here's your certification, have a nice life, you know, live long and prosper. You know, it is setting you up so that when you are done, you feel comfortable and qualified, as my dad would say, to hang a shingle on your door.
Well, so you believe that you're able to help people awaken their own abilities to do this kind of thing and to help others through your own practice?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
That is fantastic. You know, if others are sensitive to energy and they want to learn to explore beyond the five senses, then what do you recommend to them in the immediate sense? I know this is something that you already offer in classes, but and it would take a much longer time than probably 5 minutes to try and encapsulate that. But right now, in the immediate sense, what kind of pointers can you give people who want to explore the world beyond the known senses?
Well, I mean, and I think to me, one of the very first things, actually, I'm going to give, well, the first thing is what we were talking about earlier is about paying attention. I was thinking this and this happened. You know, I was feeling this and this happened, you know, and just start making those connections between what you were thinking, what you were sensing, you know, like you might have, you know, like, Michael, you might be thinking about Chris, just for whatever reason you don't even know, and the phone rings and it's Chris. It's like, boom.
Happens,
you know,
all the time.
And instead of saying, oh, well, that was a coincidence, maybe it could be that you're having a psychic experience, you know? And so just starting to pay attention to that, because I think once people start recognizing the experiences they're having in their lives, they will... You know, it's kind of like gratitude. You know, once you start acknowledging it, you start having more.
Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, it's... Sorry to interrupt, Micah. It's funny that you say that, because it brought to mind... you know, you said the Micah thinking of Chris. It brought to mind something that happened actually a week ago today. Normally on Tuesdays, Micah and I spend the entire day together doing show prep and research for the impending show. And last Tuesday, I woke up thinking, you know, okay, today Mike and I are going to Reynolds Mansion. And then I called Micah, or Micah called me, I forget which one, and he told me that we were, in fact, going to Reynolds Mansion. And it was maybe a 30-minute, you know, a 30-minute time period between me thinking and him communicating. And I brought it up to him, and he, you know, he basically said what you've been saying, that maybe I should be paying more attention to the what I perceive as coincidences that are happening in my life.
My ex-husband and I were very connected on that level. I hate to admit this live on air.
Go for it. It's too late now.
It's too late. But I would sit there and I would think, you know, maybe we could have barbecue for dinner tonight. You know, and I would happen to look at the clock and go, well, it's 2 o'clock. And so he would come home and go, hey, why don't we have barbecue for dinner tonight? And I'll be like, okay, well, I thought about it at 2 o'clock. What time did you think about it? Because we had gotten to the point in our connection where we were trying to figure out who thought of something first so that the other one picked it up.
So,
pretty scary.
So who actually did come up with that first? who wanted barbecue more, you or he?
Well, it kind of went back and forth, but I'm going to tell you this really quick story with him. So he and I got divorced. So the day our divorce finalized, my boyfriend at the time and I decided to go out to dinner. We went to Outback. Who shows up while we're sitting in Outback?
Oh, of course. Boy, if I could count how many times that has happened to me, Rita. I'd gone through a bad breakup. I was hanging out with another of my exes who is just a lifelong friend of mine. In fact, I'll tell you her name, Antonia. Antonia and I, who are still to this day very close, very good friends, we were hanging out together that night. And of all places, I drove to this little suburb outside of the Asheville metro. And as I'm driving into this little suburb, there was a little chain of restaurants down there in front of a busy intersection across from a Barnes & Noble. And I remember as I was driving in there thinking to myself, you know, this individual is going to be there. And sure enough, Antonia and I pull up, and there she was standing there. And she doesn't even live in this town, is the thing. There she was. And I thought the chances that not only she would be visiting at that time, but that she would be standing there, and that I would have, I kid you not, what I can only call a premonition that I would see her there that night. And then, of course, have my my ex with me in the car at that point, and then explain to her, okay, well, that's interesting.
Okay, and so what part of psychic don't you get with that one?
Well, there's nothing I don't get. And that's what she said. Antonia's response was, well, why aren't you charging for this if you can do this? But speaking of, you know, Rita, tell the listeners a little bit more about how they can learn about you and your work and where they can find out more about you.
Okay. I mean, my main website is www.soulhealer.com, and it kind of is a portal to all of my other websites. So there are links on there to the Just Energy Radio website, which is the radio show, airs live every Friday afternoon from 2 to 4. But it also has 5 years' worth of archives on that site, www.justenergyradio.com. And there's also a link to the training program information, which is AppliedEnergeticsInstitute.com. Lots of articles, lots of books. I sell some products. It's a one-stop shop, soulhealer.com.
Excellent. Dr. Rita Louise, thank you so much for joining us on the program. And folks, you know how to find her. We'll have her information linked in the show notes just as well. We hope you'll come back on the program.
I'd love to. You guys are fun.
Well, we do try to be fun. And even though we take a lighthearted approach, we are very serious about this. In fact, I think we are probably more serious before the show than we are when we're actually on air, only because we realize there has to be an entertainment factor. If you heard the conversations that went on before we went to air, you know, and people saw how serious we actually were, we just wouldn't be any fun to listen to.
Well, okay.
And I understand. I think on Friday the 13th of April, I'm going to be on your program as well. Am I correct?
Yes, you are. Friday, April 13th. Ooh. I get you Friday the 13th.
Exactly. That's going to be remarkable. I will look forward to talking to you again, my friend. Dr. Rita Louise, thank you. You're always welcome here on the Graylian Report.
All right. Thanks, Micah. Thanks, Chris. Bye, guys.
Have a great evening, Rita. And that wraps up our interview with Dr. Rita Louise. That was fun. You know, I always love it when we can have a person who is psychic, intuitive, and they're also fun to talk about. So when we come back, we're going to continue our fun tonight. Oh, it's always fun here on the Graylian Report, isn't it? We've got a number of odd approaches to things going on in the news right now. Have you ever heard of the horned demon cat of World War II? What about the Matiasma? Do you know what a Matiasma is? We'll delve into the evil eye when we come back here on the Graylian Report.
Theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
Welcome back to the program, the third and final hour of this week's edition of the Graylian Report. We just finished a conversation, and I think that was a very enjoyable conversation. Dr. Rita Louise, a psychic intuitive and a medical practitioner who is capable of training others in that art of medical intuition. It's very interesting. There's a new book, as a matter of fact, that I reviewed recently for Anomalous Books. It's called Consulting Spirit, which deals with a medical practitioner and his own experiences with medical, a practical mediumship in the medical field. It's well worth checking out. Take a look at anomalousbooks.com. The book, again, is called Consulting Spirit. Very interesting book. And speaking of interesting, taking a look over at the Shuker Nature blog. Of course, that is the blog of the famous cryptozoologist Dr. Carl Shuker. He's got an interesting story up there that I thought we'd touch on this third hour. Kick this hour off with a fun story that everybody can relate to, because everybody at some point in their life has known a hellacious horned demon cat, right? Come on, you know you have. I know I've known a hellacious horned demon cat. We used to have a studio cat that hung around here. No, Nikki Buns wasn't a hellacious horned demon cat.
Hell, so many words. You just described my last girlfriend.
Yeah, I started to say, I think it's so many words, you know.
The hellacious horned, yeah, we've all known hellacious horned demon cats. No, this is a true story. Okay, according to the Shuker Nature blog, it could have been a scene enacted from Dante's Inferno. Even the clouds seem to be wreathed in flames as torrent after torrent of plummeting German bombs screamed through the darkened skies over South London. We're setting the stage for a real story here. And a flurry of shrieking souls in everlasting torment could be heard upon its shuddering streets. And in the midst of this panorama of pandemonium was Howard Leland, one of many volunteers with the ARP, the Air Raid Precautions, who had been boldly defying the deadly rain of missiles throughout that fearful evening in October of 1943. It was a desperate bid to minimize its malevolent effects. But little did Leland realize that he would soon encounter something infinitely more sinister and more malign than anything conjured forth by the wartime enemy. Apparently, while he was trudging the streets that evening, Leland ran into a deserted house to take shelter. The building's interior was pitch black, but with the aid of his torch, he located a staircase nearby and rested on the bottom step for a while, waiting for his latest airborne assault to end. And suddenly, he was overtaken. A cold shadow of fear swept across him, for he sat there, and as he did, he realized, indefinably, but undeniably, that he was no longer alone in that house. There was something there with him. Leland switched his torch on again, because surely he thought he could reveal the identity of whatever may have been there in the house. He began to direct the penetrating beam onto the topmost stair above him and beheld a hellish sight that transfixed him with fear, expelled him from his own mind, and from all that evening's previous horrors. Within a mere instant, crouched upon the stair was a huge, hairy beast with tabby-like stripes of black and brown. There were clawed paws, there were blazing eyes that glowed like twin infernos, mesmerizing Leland with their incandescent glaze. It would have resembled a monstrous cat, he said, had it not been for the pair of sharp-pointed horns that protruded directly out of the skull. God, what the hell was that thing? For almost a minute, Leland remained motionless, held in thrall by the cold aura of palpable evil that radiated inexorably from the beast's unblinking eyes, and then it moved. As though he had hoped this thing might have just been some kind of a, you know, some sort of a statuette or something similar to that. No, this thing moved, and with a single colossal leap, it sprang from the top stair, plunging down into the shadowy room. But before it reached the ground, it had vanished completely. And Leland, as far as he could tell, was alone again. And yet this creature's presence had not entirely gone, for Leland could plainly hear a spine-chilling, yowling cry echoing throughout the empty room. So at that same instant, the sound of human footsteps came from the open front door. And then, as if breaking the spell, this veil of evil lifted. The eldritch cries ceased immediately, and through the door walked two of Leland's air raid police comrades. Their reassuringly familiar forms and voices swiftly dispersed the crowd of with a shroud of terror that had encompassed the man only moments before. And he told them what had happened. He shared his own experience there at the foot of the stairs. Neither of his friends had heard anything when entering the house, but he didn't expect them to treat his account entirely seriously. I mean, how the hell would you take something so incredible seriously? And so that's why he was surprised when they began to listen silently as he described this creature that he had seen. And with grave expressions throughout the story, they made no attempt to scoff or scorn his words. When Leland had finished, his friends informed him that he was not the first person to have spied this alleged feline monster. Quite the contrary, it had been seen by many different eyewitnesses over a period of several years in that area, and the sightings were always more or less the same. There was an immense cat, complete with horns protruding from its skull and demonic eyes, that had been seen, just like the one he had seen that evening, squatting at the top of the staircase. And in hope that a more straightforward explanation may be forthcoming, the three men went on up the stairs. They searched everywhere thoroughly for any physical evidence of that creature's reality, but none was found. Well, the story goes on, still disturbed by the memory of that grotesque entity. Leland later visited a renowned clairvoyant. The man's name was John Pendragon. Pendragon. Similar to the characters, of course, from the Arthurian legends. And this man recalled to him that that house, located on a large map of London there in his office, he was able to place his forefinger on the precise spot marking it. He said that Pendragon's mind had become suddenly filled with a whirling vista of cats, countless furry wraiths swirling all around at the top of the deserted house's stairs in a screeching, spitting vortex of feline fury. A mad maelstrom of undying hate. Almost like it was some kind of a demonic presence. Whatever this thing was, it resembled a cat, but it was no cat. This was something else. Not even a horned demon cat. And at the very center was something much larger. Something that certainly wasn't a cat. This coming to the mind of Pendragon, and as he envisions this entity, he sees not a cat. He says it was a man. A haggard-looking man. And he was despairing. He had a noose that he held in his hand. And in this vision, the man was about to place the noose around his own neck. Well, after describing this vision to Leland, Pendragon asked him to make inquiries among the house's neighbors to discover whether any details of the history of the house itself, or maybe even those who had lived there previously, might correspond with the vision of the man with the noose in his hands. A week later, Leland returned, and he was bearing some extremely interesting and perhaps even vindicating news. One of the house's former inhabitants had actually been an ardent practitioner of the black arts, in the vain hope of improving what he had perceived to be a wretched and unfulfilled life. In accordance with one particularly grisly ritual, he had routinely slaughtered numerous cats for sacrifice upon an unholy altar. Ultimately, the balance of his mind had become totally unhinged, and he had committed suicide there in that very same house, hanging himself with a noose, just as Pendragon had envisioned, and suspending himself from the banister at the top of the stairs. And shortly afterward, the great horned cat was seen there for the first time. And, of course, its spectral yowling, those cries, which some say have been heard ever since. So what was that creature? Was that the spirit, the culmination of the spirits of the deceased cats that had been killed there at the house? Was it the spirit of the man and his vile black practices, dark arts, that had no effect in terms of helping him reach that fulfillment that he sought in life? Had he conjured a demon? Was there some sort of a malevolent spirit, a class 4 metaspectre in Ghostbuster speak? Who knows what actually was encountered?
Well, I was going to say, it's always interesting to me when I hear stories like this, because you can always, I think, make the connection that I know at least in Egyptian, ancient Egyptian, you know, religion and practices, that cats were always the, I guess, the keepers of the underworld. And mm-hmm. I think there are several other cultures that always held that belief as well. And so it's always interesting to see, you know, like this demonic cat.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read plenty of stories over the years of this kind of, you know, people perceiving those, at least those kinds of creatures, I guess, in relation to events like those.
Well, you know, just think about the idea of the black cat, you know.
Yeah, I was getting ready to say.
Black cat cross your path, you know. There's the tradition of the black cat as a, you know, witch's kin or a familiar.
Edgar Allan Poe's The Black Cat.
Yes.
Story.
Yes, of course. These characters appear in you know, not only myth and folklore, but also you know, more modern Western literature and things like that, which are arguably borrowed from those rich traditions, you know, that incorporate cats as witches, familiars, and animals that are spirit animals. And then, yes, as you mentioned, Matt, you know, we look back at the ancient Egyptian therianthropic representations where there are human bodies with animal heads, and we often see with gods or goddesses like Isis, for instance, that in various interpretations of those goddesses, we saw a cat head, as well as other animals, too, animals that were revered for having strength and for representing strength among the Egyptians. You know, there were snakes, the jackal, of course, who I think was rather prevalent among in depictions of the god Anubis, in terms of, you know, the jackal representing kind of a being that could kind of exist in a transitory state or as a sort of a guide into the afterlife. But often these cats and these snakes and birds, the falcon was another that appeared you know, an awful lot, especially depictions of the god Ra. And these interpretations were intended to display strength in the therianthropic, that is, the animal-headed representations of these gods in ancient Egyptian culture. The prevalence of the cat, however, is fairly unique. You know, in Africa, there are traditions that incorporate what are known as the we're cats, you know, and we're leopards, and things like that. And then, of course, you know, in the West, we have the aforementioned associations with witchery and the black arts, that the cat is kind of a witch's familiar. And that the cat itself might even be some sort of an animal capable of traversing the physical and the non-physical realms. I think it's a pretty interesting connection that could be made there. So what was this animal? You know, this is interesting because this story obviously seems to kind of deal, you know, and again, you know, when we tell stories like this on the program, I tend to kind of do a loose paraphrasing of the program. The actual story that's featured at Shuker Nature, or Dr. Carl Shuker's blog, which is Carl Shuker, that's KarlSHuker, carlshuker.blogspot.com. You can check out his Blogspot website there for the entire story, but I give you kind of a synopsis here. That sounds to me a lot more like something that is supernatural in nature, as opposed to being a flesh and blood you know, monster, a cryptozoological creature, which, of course, Dr. Shuker is best known for his study of. You know, I've got an interesting story that has to do with odd encounters with animals, and I'll share that one when we come back. It's funny because, you know, when you do this kind of a program, sometimes you don't know what direction the show's going to go. And despite all the other programs or all the other show notes and stories that we have lined up, I think I've got one that will follow up nicely with that here on the Gray Lane Report. We'll touch on that when we come back right after this. Stay tuned.
Some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the InceptionRadioNetwork.com. We'll see you there.
They were first known as the Abominable Snowmen.
Sasquatch. Sasquatch.
Perhaps the most amazing Bigfoot sighting in recent years occurred when Elmer Frombach of Seattle, Washington, took his family on an outing near the Canadian border.
Oh my God, it's Bigfoot!
Sasquatch.
Welcome back to the program. It is the Grailian Report. That's the infamous Sasquatch song. This is a farcical amalgamation of strange audio. I thought it would be appropriate to put this on because, you know, if you haven't been over to the Grailian Report yet this week, you should go check it out. There is a very strange article there. Well, listen to this.
That he saw. I saw a big, black, hairy mass right behind all of those rocks and twigs.
Sasquatch.
Join me.
Anyway, that's the infamous Grailian Report Bigfoot song. That's the music that you can expect to hear anytime we're going to talk about Bigfoot on this program. And if you visit www.grailianreport.com, front and center there, you'll see an article. Well, actually, it's going to be directly underneath the show notes for this week. The article is titled, Bigfoot is an Archetype. Sasquatch Reigns Supreme Among Folk Devils. And what this article deals with are the rather high strangeness stories that associate Bigfoot with, well, strange things like disappearances. Did you know that there are a lot of reports of Bigfoot encounters where the creature actually appears to have simply vanished inexplicably? And these reports are often, more often than not, overlooked. And yes, I think that that's difficult. That's troubling. So how do we reconcile with that? Or can we reconcile with that sort of a thing? Maybe we can't. But I see that there is a nice bit of conversation that's erupted around this rather controversial theme of whether or not Bigfoot is an entirely physical flesh and blood entity. And if you'd like to get in on the conversation, visit our website, thegrailianreport.com, where you can read more about whether Bigfoot is indeed an archetypal substruct of our own inner consciousness. But that said, continuing our discussion of strange animals and weird behavior among the animal kingdom. You know, my good buddy Joshua P. Warren wrote a book called Pet Ghosts, and he'll be the first one to tell you it was a terrible title for that book. He didn't like that. He said he thought that the book should have been called Phantomals. Chris is just crying over here.
It just reminds me of manimals so much.
Manimals, yes. Well, you know, Bigfoot is a manimal. But what about phantomals? Ghostly representations in the animal kingdom, you know? And I thought it was a good idea. And he said, you know, I wish that as opposed to pet ghosts, he said, I wish that the book could have been called Phantomals. And I actually agree with him about that. You know, I think that that would have been maybe a more appropriate title for that book. And when we talk about ideas of phantomals, I want to ask each of you here in the studio, and of course, you know, those of you who are listening, if you have similar stories, you can always reach us. You know, as a matter of fact, putting the phone lines out, you know, 828-398-4886 if you'd like to call in. Skype users can reach us at Grailian Report on Skype. You can text us anytime at 828-367-7201. And then finally, of course, you can email us info@grailianreport.com if you have your own strange animal stories that you would like to share. But that said, gentlemen here in the studio, have you ever had your own odd experiences with animals that you'd like to relate? I know that Chris here is terrified of possums for some reason.
I'm not terrified of possums. I just think they have freaky people faces.
possums have man faces. I've heard people for years say that possums have man faces.
Well, there's a specific instance. One night, I was in high school. I was driving home the back way with my high school girlfriend at the time.
That was the wrong way, by the way.
Yeah, it was the wrong way. And I saw a possum in the road, and it just stared
Nobody
at me as I was
driving.
No one wants to go down that road. But this possum just stared at me while I was driving past it, and I swear to whatever deity you choose to believe or not believe in, this thing had a people face. And I know that's the way wrong way to say it, but this thing had a people face. It did not look like it had a snout. It looked like it had a nose and eyes, and just, it was gross and disheartening, and I didn't like it.
But it didn't frighten you, though.
No, it didn't frighten me. It disgusted me. Because well, these American marsupials just have no business looking like people I know.
These American... Oh, so it resembled someone you knew.
No, it just looked like a human.
Okay.
What about the R-O-U-S's?
Well, those don't exist. Rats of unusual size?
Oh, rats of unusual size? No, no, no.
Especially not in the fire swamp. They are not in the fire swamp.
Now, they say that they don't exist, but, you know, we talked about that on this program. There was a man who had actually managed to stab one with a pitchfork, you remember? And there were photographs. That was a big rat. That thing was probably more than a foot long. You remember? It looked like a wombat, in fact. Now, granted, it wasn't your average rat. It was actually a species that is known to grow that large. I'll have to dig through the archives and find out where that story went. Can you believe we've almost been in... We are all about to celebrate a year of broadcasting excellence with this incarnation of this program. You know, I've done a lot of different radio over the years. You know, it started, I think, years ago with Joshua Warren's Speaking of Strange program. Of course, I started off as a fill-in host and a producer of that program. But, you know, after that, I went to the Patriot Brigade Talk Radio Network and did the Micah Hanks program for a while, and then shortly after that, the Graylian Report followed, and we're about to be closing in on our first full year of broadcast excellence with this program. And yet, in an entire year, Matt Oakley, the kind-eyed reverend, has not told me a single ghost story about a dead pet of his. Matt, have you ever had anything along those lines happen? And it doesn't really have to be a dead pet, but I mean, have you ever had a strange story about a ghost, that you know, or a ghost animal, I should say, that you could relate?
Not really off the top of my head. I've definitely heard an array of them over the years.
Well, share one that you people. Yeah, share one that you know, because
I think one of the most interesting, and I don't know if this was a ghost animal per se, was I believe it was your brother related that one to me in the driveway of your parents' house one night. Mm-hmm. Do you recall the story?
I don't think I do, actually.
Something to do with like a werewolf shaped creature.
Oh wait, you're talking maybe about the Beast of Bray Road?
No, he said he was on the phone one night, I believe, like in the driveway at your folks' house.
Oh, so this was something he claimed he saw.
Yeah, in his rearview mirror. I mean, that's about all I recall. But I remember him telling me, being like, "Wow, it's a really weird story." And I consider you a fairly credible character witness.
Caleb is a credible character witness. Now, that said, I can't attest to him seeing a werewolf, but now, you know, this brings to mind the idea of the Beast of Bray Road, which Linda Godfrey has researched. You know, maybe we will wait until closer to Halloween, because that's the kind of, you know, thing that you want to talk about around Halloween. That's what I should do. I should book him in advance. We'll get Linda Godfrey to come on. I'll talk about the Beast of Bray Road, and I'll get Brad Steiger to come on and talk about real vampires. And then we'll do a seance where we conjure the spirit of Mary Shelley to talk about the modern Prometheus that is Frankenstein. And then maybe we could get, what's his name? Oh, who's the German director, Chris, that did the Nosferatu Phantom de Nacht? You know, the revisioning of the Nosferatu legend.
Oh, I have no
Werner
idea.
Werner Herzog, I believe, yes.
Yeah, Herzog.
We'll get Herzog to come on the program and talk about Nosferatu or something like that. Boy, that was a fantastic film. But all that said, getting back to the idea of strange encounters with animals, I think I've got a good one that I'd like to share. And this one goes back a long time ago, but it's a family story.
I've got a lot of interesting family stories along these lines that that I share from time to time here on the program. And in fact, you know, there was one of the weirder stories that dealt with my family was the disappearance of a man, which was subsequent to his disappearance in a photograph. There had been a family photograph taken in which his face didn't appear. And then, only a few days later, he literally vanished and was never seen or heard from again. And what's really interesting about that story is that although it is a family story of mine, I could even tell you the name of the individual in the photograph. His name was Claude Calloway. I had heard that story. I thought it was my father who had told me, but my father later denied having heard that story. And then one evening at my friend Joshua P. Warren's house, I was sitting in his living room, and he and I were talking about ghost stories and things, and our friend Robert McGee was there in the room with us. And Robert McGee is talking with Josh about strange family history, and Josh begins to relate this story where he describes this family member of his whose face disappeared from a photograph that was taken, and then only a few days later, this individual physically disappeared and was never seen again. And so Joshua always thought that was a really strange story, a really odd circumstance. And as I hear him relating this story to Robert McGee that night, I'm thinking, was this Claude Calloway? And I asked Joshua, what was the guy's last name? And he said, well, yeah, this was one of my relatives over in Madison County. He was a Calloway. And I said, I think we're related. And sure enough, it turns out, my father being an amateur genealogist, my dad does some research into this, and he says, you know what? That actually is indeed a branch of the Calloways that is related to your family, our family. So Joshua P. Warren, my friend, he and I had been working together for years at that point, and it turns out that Josh and I are actually related as well. But there's one final eerie twist to this story, okay? Now, Joshua had tried to gather that photograph. He'd tried to obtain it, but, you know, it had long vanished, and it was just a legend in the family that Claude Calloway had disappeared and that photograph had existed, and that just a few days before his disappearance, there had been a family photo taken where Claude was in the photo. He'd posed along with the rest of the family, but that he wasn't present in the photo when it was developed. And then, after all this situation with Joshua describing his own recollection of the story from his side of the family, and I obviously recognized it, and then of course the vindication comes that indeed this was a family member of mine, so I was absolutely certain I had heard this story at some point and that this was indeed a family member of mine, and it was actually confirmed that this was a family member of mine and that Joshua Warren and I were, by virtue of that, fourth cousins. We're talking about this, and I say to Joshua, you know, I need to talk to my dad about who actually told that story. And my father asks the same thing. He says, you know, I don't doubt that you heard the story, but the problem is no one on our side of the family could have known that, because those would have been distant cousins that had no interaction with our family members. Where did you hear the story? And I said, well, I thought it was either from you or maybe from a family member at a family reunion. I know that I heard the story when I was a kid. And Dad said, I didn't tell you that story. And in fact, I couldn't tell you who might have told you that story. I don't know where that story came from. My father was completely in the dark. He had no idea where that story could have come from. And I, on the other hand, and again, you know, call me crazy, but I am certain that I had heard the story when I was a young man. I was just a kid, and somebody had told me that story. And furthermore, if I hadn't been told the story, then tell me how it would have turned out that Claude Calloway, the man in the story that Joshua told, was none other than a cousin of mine, related to me. But the question remains, who, when I was a child, who told me that story? Creepy. Very interesting. We have yet to be able to figure that one out. But that wasn't even the story I was going to tell you. That's just the prelude to the animal story I was going to tell you. Now, my dad has been one who has tended to collect odd stories over the years. And there was one that he used to tell when I was a kid, which is, again, probably why I thought for certain that I'd heard this particular story from my father, because when I was a kid, he would always tell me these unique stories, okay, that had to do with the family and strange happenings that occurred in the family. And one such story actually took place. This was probably in the 1920s or 30s. And my long-deceased great-grandfather on my mother's side was Granddad Cordell. And he always told this story that he had been walking home one evening, and there was a little dog that came up and started walking alongside him. Now, he said that this wasn't the first time he had seen this dog. There had been many instances, in fact, where as he was walking home, and it was just before dusk, and he'd be coming home from work, he said that there was this little dog along this certain stretch of fence that when he would be walking, this little dog would come along and everything, and it would see him coming. And as he was walking home every afternoon, he said this little dog would run up alongside the fence, and it would walk alongside, you know, that fence, walk right alongside Granddad Cordell there for the duration of where this fence went, okay? And the entire length of the fence, that little dog would walk along with him, and then it would leave him, and he would continue on home. And this happened several times, and he didn't think a whole lot about it. He thought, you know, okay, well, there's that little dog. Great, there he is. And so it was a particularly warm spring evening, and he was coming home. He had his jacket slung over his shoulder, and as he's walking along, he's approaching that fence, and he sees the little dog sitting there in front of the fence, and he thinks, oh, there's that good little guy. Again, this had happened once or twice already, so he was familiar with the dog. He had even come to expect that maybe the dog would be there after this happened, you know, 3-4 times. This little guy would sit there in front of that fence every night. And so Cordell's walking along, and the little dog starts trotting along pleasantly alongside him, and they're walking alongside the fence, and he thinks, he's such a cute little guy. And Granddad Cordell said, I bent down at that point as I'm walking in mid-stride. I reached down to pet the little dog, and I went down for his head. And he said, as I went for the dog's head, my hand passed right through his head like he wasn't even there. He said the little dog was a ghost, and that after that he never saw that dog again. But that for several nights in a row, as he would be walking along that particular fence, this little dog would appear and walk along with him, and that when he went to pet it, his hand passed right through that dog. That was another one of the family legends that was told, and I think it fits very well into that realm of the spectral animal stories that are told from time to time. So, who knows what could be made of all of this madness, you know? Are there really horned demonic cats and things like that that might haunt old buildings where black magic rituals had taken place? And when we talk about dogs, you know, there are, of course, the legends in the British Isles of the Black Shuck, the black dog, you know? There are a lot of stories. In fact, Sherlock Holmes mystery, The Hound of the Baskervilles, was based loosely on that story of there being spectral black dogs, hounds at the gate. And Chris, you and I even had an experience of sorts one night at Reynolds Mansion that involved what I like to call hounds at the gate or hellhounds.
Yeah, involving the phantom, well, not really phantom, they were quite real, the dogs that were fighting at quite an inopportune time.
Yeah, here we were. It was the middle of the night. We were doing, you know, Chris and I actually, we had the entire Reynolds Mansion, which for those of you who aren't familiar with it, we've done live remote broadcasts from Reynolds Mansion in the past. We're probably going to be doing others because I'm right now authoring a book about Reynolds Mansion, in fact.
And this was the evening of our first live remote from Reynolds Mansion. Matthew went on his way, but Mike and I stayed very nearly the night at Reynolds Mansion, but
we were there till about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, but then we didn't end up having the wherewithal to stay the night.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah, but because, you know, well, I'll tell you, I remember what was going on that night was that I think I had just had a cold. I remember we were doing that program and my throat was so raspy, And you were right in the middle of this sickness.
Oh yeah, I was chugging emergency mixed with Earl Grey tea for days. So I was in that weird, gross, sick state of being in the middle of a cold, being hyped up on caffeine, but still being really tired because I'm sick, but also having that vitamin. So there are like 5 to 10 minute bouts of I feel okay, and then I just come crashing back down in the depths of sickness. It was pretty terrible.
I remember at one point, you know, I was in there. We were in the library, and it was about 1:30 in the morning. And you'd passed out, you know, and I was sitting there reading a book, you know, just hoping that something was going to come, you know, walking down the staircase. I mean, this is, and the building was built in 1847. You know, it is one of the oldest standing brick structures in Western North Carolina. It's an antebellum mansion, and it is renowned for its hauntings. And I thought, boy, if there's ever going to be an opportunity that we're going to see something, tonight's the night. And although we didn't see any ghosts or anything like that, I'll tell you, that evening, as we were leaving, you'd gone out onto the porch to smoke. We never see dogs. I mean, there's a gated community right up the hill from Reynolds Mansion, and then the surrounding area. I mean, it's a very quiet, very upscale neighborhood.
Yeah, and to be fair, Billy does have two English or French?
English bulldogs, yeah.
But he had them. He had Rhett and Scarlett up in the room with him.
There's absolutely no way that Rhett and Scarlett, the two English bulldogs, could have been outside that night. They do get in fights from time to time. But, you know, Billy, the owner of Reynolds Mansion, had already retired for the evening. Those two dogs were already in the caretaker's suite. And he confirmed that after the fact for me. He confirmed that after the fact and told me that, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, those dogs were not outside. Now, they're in the black darkness of night. You were standing on the front porch, and these two dogs come running by, raising absolute pure hell in front of Reynolds Mansion.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I saw them, so I knew for a fact they weren't Rhett and or Scarlet, because they weren't, you know, massive specimens of English bulldog. They almost looked like mutts, but they were probably, I guess if you want to, you know, qualify size, if you remember Benji, they were about Benji's size, but not as scraggly. Huh. And I remember I was outside, it was kind of windy, I was smoking on the front porch or side porch, depending on your orientation, and and I hear, you know, what sounds like what could be, you know, squirrels or something in the bushes, because that just is a matter of course here in Asheville and the outlying areas. But then I hear what sounds distinctly like running, and I look to my right where the front yard is, and I see one dog tearing across the yard and another dog tearing after it, both growling. And I think, well, that's really creepy, and I hope they don't come up here because I'd hate to have to kick a dog. And so I'm, you know, continuing smoking. I haven't finished yet. And then they come back, and they stop right where I can see them. It's almost as if they realize this is a stage and they're putting on a show. They stop and battle it out for a good 45 seconds, which I realize doesn't seem like a long time, but if you've ever, you know, been in a fight or any sort of full contact sport like wrestling or anything like that, 45 seconds can seem like an eternity. So I'm watching them battle it out, and then they run off and into the gravel driveway where it's even louder, and they're growling and barking and yipping and biting at each other. And so I just go in and I'm done, because this is just too much. It's not so much I'm scared of the supernatural, but I don't want to get bit by a dog.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just ridiculous.
That wasn't our inclination that they were, you know, black hounds of hell that night. But, you know, I told Billy that story after the fact, and he said, you know, that's really weird, because he says we never see dogs like that around here and everything, and it being, you know, a gated community up the hill there and everything, I mean, it's possible that those dogs came from God knows where, but we'd been talking about, and this is the funny thing, there's this kind of theme at Reynolds Mansion of the macabre and a vampiric kind of thing, and a lot of it has to do with dark shadows. And the little synchronicity was with regard to the dogs, that on the old program, Dark Shadows, when Barnabas Collins would show up at night, especially, you would hear these hounds off in the background start to growl and bark anytime Barnabas came near. And so here we were, Chris and I were investigating ghosts at Reynolds Mansion, We didn't see any ghosts, but there were hellhounds literally barking at the gate. We'll continue this discussion of strange animals and ghosts on the other side of this break. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks.
Fearless, adventurous, bold, and daring. These words all combine to define intrepid, both as an expression within the English lexicon and when describing Intrepid Magazine, the new leader in clear and reasoned thinking. Intrepid Magazine features in-depth analysis of the latest science, culture, conspiracy, politics, and unexplained phenomena, like UFOs and the paranormal. Subscribe to Intrepid for 1 year and receive 12 issues, all for just $14.95. Intrepid Magazine, boldly going. To learn more, visit intrepidmag.com.
The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report, the final segment of tonight's edition of the broadcast. Matt's holding his breath, ready for the show to be over with. Nah, not really. He's the Reverend. He has very kind eyes. You know, Matt, are you giving me the stink eye? What did I do here, buddy?
No, but your house still smells like soup.
My house, well, I don't know what my house would smell like right now. Maybe the Graylian babies are over there making stuff.
Well, I said distinctly when we got all the way down to our studio... that it kind of smelled like baby's breath. You know, the little filler they put in with roses?
Well, you know, Holly was actually down here the other day, and I noticed that every time Holly comes down here, she won't own up to it, but what I'm told is that when Holly comes down to the studio, that she doesn't like the musty aroma of the hollow earth, and therefore she...
Man.
Yes, the manliness. Musty aroma of man. Yeah, pure manliness. Yeah, Holly, she's probably listening and really angry right now. You know, Holly, back when we did the show during the daytime, she used to listen more. Now she claims that she doesn't. She claims that she doesn't have a reason to have to listen,
which is weird because we make her stay on duty for our shows. So I mean, it's not like she's got anything better to do.
Yeah, except for when she's at home cooking dinner, and we're still, you know, calling her. You're listening, right? Yeah, I'm listening. Well, did you listen last week? What did we talk about last week?
Weird stuff. You're right.
She's like, you know, let me be a 9-to-5, please. You know, it's funny. If you guys want to, but you know, that's the thing is that, you know, in this business, a lot of people do kind of keep odd hours, you know. If I get a phone call from Tom Danheiser, Tom Danheiser is, of course, the producer of Coast to Coast AM. Anytime I hear anything from Tom Danheiser, usually it's right before he and George Norrie take the airwaves, which is, in this time zone, that's right before 1 o'clock in the morning. I think the earliest I've ever spoken to Tom Danhauser on the phone is 7 p.m. Eastern time. So, you know, a lot of us are kind of vampires in this business. But Matt, nonetheless, even though you have kind eyes, I could see, man, I would have to say that the way that you looked at me a few minutes ago, you know, if looks could kill, I might be dead after that look.
Nah, I'm maimed, maybe, but not dead.
Well, if looks could kill, though, well, would more people be dead? Have you ever heard of what the Greeks call the matiasma? Are you familiar with the matiasma, Chris?
No.
Well, the matiasma is essentially a tradition that is known... Actually, it's not just in the Greek tradition. Okay. It's known elsewhere as the evil eye. And there was a fantastic article about the matiasma. I think it was in Fortean Times, God, probably 10 years ago. I remember reading this article and thinking it was incredibly interesting. The story of the evil eye, a curse. They've always said, you know, that the eye is the window to the soul of an individual. But perhaps the real truth is that it is the window of intent. Because when you drive on the highway and you get cut off, the first thing, what do you do, Matt, when somebody cuts you off and you're driving down the road? What's the first thing you do to them?
Chase them down and make them feel like an idiot.
Okay, anybody else, when they would be cut off driving down the road, would probably lock eyes with that person and give them the stink eye, right? I don't know where that expression comes from, the stink eye, but we might also refer to this colloquially as the evil eye. Okay, we use our eyes to correct misbehaving children. Or since we were talking about pets in the last segment, sometimes we do the same thing with our pets, our animal friends as well. We shoot a look of incredulity when someone says something ridiculous. Shut up, Chris! Or we even advise our friends and family to always look someone in the eye if they're going to go for a job interview. The eye, according to many, is the very most powerful organ linked to the very most dominant sense among the five senses available to humans. Okay? We're fixated on it. We use it against others. Our eyes, that is. And the expressions that our eyes will betray at various times when we interact with others. When used against us, we fear that evil eye because we know that it means something bad. And even ancient tribesmen in ancient cultures were terrified by the eyes of wild animals seen watching them from the forest nearby. At any moment, those creatures might pounce, and in the modern world, we still fear being watched for similar reasons. Reports of strange man-like beings like Sasquatch are often described as beginning with seeing red eyes emanating from the darkness. And similar reports even stem from cultural and folkloric descriptions of vampires over the years as well. Our brains are designed to fear the eye and the evil that the eye can transmit with a mere gaze. But does it have anything to do with anything other than superficial power? Well, there's an interesting article at the website paranormala.com, Weird News Stories and Beyond, titled If Looks Could Kill, The Evil Eye Throughout History. And it says there that folklore attributes the underlying power of the eye to envy. Coveting a neighbor's property was thought to create the evil eye, intentionally or unintentionally. Eyeing the neighbor's prized cow could have been at fault for its untimely death, or looking enviously at a prime crop could cause it to wither, or even seeing your neighbor's wealth with envy could cause that neighbor to lose it. Children were thought to be particularly susceptible to the evil eye, or again in the Greek tradition, what they call the matiasma. It was a belief arising from a number of unexplainable infant deaths before modern medicine identified those causes. A barren woman could be blamed for bringing the evil eye on another child, subconsciously jealous that she could not have her own. Now, folklorist and UC Berkeley professor Alan Dundas once made the case that the evil eye's effects almost always involved withering, drying, and death. This might explain various remedies seen in many cultures which always seem to involve wetness One remedy, for instance, for countering the evil eye was the practice of washing the ground after a person with the eye had passed through. And the Jewish custom that fish were immune to the eye because they were always wet. In the Greek tradition, of course, of the matiasma, if someone was seen with the evil eye, often what a person would do is lick their thumb and then press it to their forehead. There were similar processes and practices that involved wetness like this. Have you ever received the evil eye? And if you have, what were those negative effects? You know, I think this week's edition of the program, I want to leave you with a question. And if you have had an experience where you felt that something really truly strange occurred to you as a result of an interaction with the evil eye, well, we would like to hear about it here on the Graylian Report. You can email us info@graylianreport.com in the space between programs. We'd love to hear from you, and if your story is a really, really good one, we might feature it on next week's edition of the program. That wraps it up for this week. On behalf of all of us here with the program, producer Chris Hayes, engineer Matt Oakley, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Holly, and all of us here at the Graylian Report, I'm Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South, and until next time, my friends, as always, stay strange.